The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
It's 7:30 on this Tuesday morning and you're very welcome along to OTB AM. It's Owen and Anthony Moyles with you right the way through until 9:30 this morning, and we've got some Champions League coming your way with John Bruin very shortly. We'll have Hector O'Hughagon with us later on as well. We'll be chatting to Joseph O'Brien live from Melbourne after 8 o'clock as well, which is great news. But most importantly this morning, we're picking our Gaelic football team of the decade, because it is the year ending in the number 9, which is when all these lists start to happen, Anthony. And you've been agonising over this list all night, it looks like.
I have been, Owen. I haven't slept. You put me under pressure. I got the call yesterday and then this sneaky text from me, you know, saying, oh, would you mind just picking your team of the decade? I was like, okay, yeah. Yeah, well, actually, I think my response was like, really? You want me to do this in 24 hours? I've learned a couple of things. One, I think you're better off just going with the first thing that comes into your head.
Yes.
Because second thing, I asked a good friend of mine last night, Paul Lester, is like, listen, give me an idea what you think. And he came back with 7 or 8 that I hadn't even thought of. So I was like, oh, agonizing over that all night. It's difficult.
It really is.
Bias is a terrible thing, I think, because you've obviously got Dublin's dominance. But then you have to go all the way back. Like, it's funny, you look at the All-Star Awards of 2010, and I'd say there's, you know, a lot of people who'd be like, who's that guy? Who won that?
There's an Irish Examiner team of the half decade that was done in 2015, and Aidan Walsh is in it. Now, to be fair, they say that he's going to phase out because he's picked hurling in that particular year. And then they have challengers for certain areas of positions where it's like, Paul Flynn is going well so far in this decade, but we think Paul Kerrigan is going to be the person who takes over as like the best swing forward of the decade.
This was the Examiner.
Yeah, it was, in fairness. But it was a tough thing for me as well, Anthony. I agonized over it for the entirety of 3 minutes.
Ah, like, come on.
So
you plagiarized basically someone else's team of the decade.
What I did was I wrote out my team of the decade and then I started reading and I was like, okay, good point. Colm Keyes, I think, has picked his already. Good point, Colm. I forgot about that entire county, let alone that player. Which we won't reveal things until about an hour's time, I think, this morning on OTB AM. Okay. But
just more time for me to stew.
Basically, it's like, it's pretty obvious what the teams are going to be. It's Dublin. Then it's a question of who is actually the second. But it's either going to be Mayo or it's going to be Kerry in terms of kind of coming up with the second place amount of teams or any. Like, if somebody came up to me and said, here's my starting 15, and it was Cluxton to Cooper to Philly McMahon to Michael Fitzsimons, and I kept going Dublin player, Dublin player, Dublin player all the way down, I'd be like, well, it's hard to make a case against any of those.
It kind of is, you know? And I had a number of criteria, so I don't know if you want me to reveal that yet.
Yes, go for it.
Well, I suppose the way I kind of put myself in the picture of, say, full back or full forward, I was trying to pick a player that has been, first of all, kind of iconic for that team that he played on. And second of all, he's been really iconic in that position. So in other words, a guy that you don't necessarily... Like, if I was playing full forward, who do I not want to see come out over the last 10 years as the full back? He may or may not have won an All-Ireland. You know, so I kind of went with a bit, but then I changed some positions. So there's no real read-through. If anyone wants to overanalyze my criteria, it's probably that it was a certain criteria for certain players that I just wanted to wedge in there, and then I abandoned it for other guys.
Well, I went for this very scientific criteria. I went for the best player in each position.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's really really out there.
I probably should have tried that.
Like, forget this nonsense about being iconic or whatever. Who's the best footballer?
There's some guys who... So there's certain positions where there's a serious amount of competition for. And then there's some other positions where you kind of go, full back is not...
It's the lightest line for me as well. Half forward and full forward, obviously, are the two lines. And the half backs, it's been the decade of the half back, hasn't it?
Half back was ridiculous. So I had to shift a few. I think I had to do a little bit of All-Star award ceremony. People going, huh? Brian Howard, number 6? I had to do a little bit of that.
Because it's amazing, really, when you think about, like, is evolution too strong a word? Like, the last decade had plenty of attacking half backs as well, but Jim McGuinness's style of play, which of course came to fruition this decade, that was predicated on the fitness and the athleticism and the attacking instincts of their halfbacks. Like, all those great Mayo teams have had fantastic halfbacks.
Yeah.
And of course, you have one of the greatest players of all time in Jack McCaffrey, who is a halfback. And oh, the spoiler alert: Jack McCaffrey might be in both of our teams. Who knows? I haven't seen Anthony's team, so who knows? But I think hopefully these teams will kind of indicate where the decade has gone. There's one suggestion on my team as well that's probably a bit of a hark back to the last decade. But we'll get into that a little bit later on. Yeah. We would love to hear your suggestions for your team of the decade. Who gets onto your team? You can tweet us at Off the Ball. You can use the hashtag OTBAM this morning. Let's tell you what is coming up on OTBAM this Tuesday morning. The sports pages coming your way in just a moment. Joseph O'Brien, as I say, live from Melbourne after the Melbourne Cup last night. It was an unfortunate finish for him last night, coming in fourth. Frankie Dettori on board his horse, getting a ban as well for careless riding. We've got Champions League at 8:20 this morning. John Bruin will be joining us at that point. Sports news with Tom Malone at 8:30. The Gaelic football team of the decade, as we've just been speaking about, at 9:20 this morning. And then Hector has been in the USA. It's a brand new TG Cahir TV show, and he's been in the Deep South, and he's great. So he's got some great sports stories to tell us. So that's coming your way at 9:05. Before all that, it is time for the back pages. OTB AM. Going to start this morning with the Irish Mirror. Trauma is the headline. Distraught son could miss Spurs' Champions League clash as club are offering him counselling following the horrific injury to Gomez. Now, Everton have revealed that their midfielder is expected to make a full recovery after operation, as Ronaldo insists he will be back stronger. So it's a pretty tough story, like, on everybody involved here. And of course, Tottenham are appealing the red card for Heung-min Son as well. Here as well, another story involving your beloved Tottenham Hotspur. Parrots in mixed plans for crunch Danish clash, says Paul O'Hare. So he will be in the Ireland squad proper, Troy Parrott, for the key Euro 2020 qualifier against Denmark and New Zealand. So it's the first time he's made the final cut.
Yeah, it's good to see. The couple of clips a couple of weeks ago of the goals that he scored, I think, in the under 21 game or the result, it was just like, I mean, he's a player. He has absolutely everything. The question, of course, is he too young? Will he be able to handle it? Will it be too much expectation heaped on him and all that stuff?
What do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I think if you're good enough, you know, it doesn't really make a difference. I think he's going to come in. I think, these guys are used to playing, you know, at that level and a serious level all the way up from early schoolboy. So, you know, he's in Spurs. He's in and around the first team. He's mixing with all of those players. He's obviously very, very highly rated over there. So, look, it's not like we're, you know, inundated with a massive amount of talent up there.
What is the last instance of a youngster in professional football crumbling under the weight of expectation? It might happen at a World Cup for England or something like that, but like, this is still the Republic of Ireland. Where is the pressure? It's not like Robbie Keane is injured in the middle of his top class career and all of a sudden you've got to fill his boots. You're going into a team that can't find a goal. They're begging for goals and they can't find one. So it's the opposite of pressure.
Absolutely agree. I'd say just go in and do what you have to do. You know, like, I mean, literally take it on, because anything is better than, you know, the bar is here. You know, just go in and just raise it for us. So I think it's definitely worthwhile getting him in, giving him a chance. But he's good. He's really, really good. I have the Indo. And I couldn't believe this actually yesterday, because he was one of my players of the World Cup. Was Delande is actually looking like he's going to go, or he is going to Munster next year. So reports that Munster swoop for Springboks pair, Damien Delande and Orji Snyman are going into Munster next year, which is a big coup for Munster, considering obviously what has just gone on. So fair play to them there. Also, Parrott prime for senior debut. That is, Mick McCarthy has confirmed that Troy Parrott is in line to make a senior debut this month. And then the Irish hockey team will get 100% support for the Olympics, said Leo Varadkar.
Yeah, he's at the game, I think, on Sunday evening in Donnybrook. The Delande stuff, and we may as well just show the front page of the Irish Examiner sports section, is a big story. The added bite they go for, World Cup winner Delande set for Munster.
I thought he was excellent.
He was fantastic.
Oh, he was, like, I mean, you know, people were kind of saying, you know, it was a bit predictable and, you know, the South African back play and why weren't they left, but he was unbelievable. There was one of the games, I can't remember the exact game, where his defence was just phenomenal. He had come in, he had tackled someone, he had chased back around. I remember just watching him, I was just like, because I didn't really know much about him. And he's a big unit and he's exactly what Munster need.
It's something that I've thought about over the last couple of weeks when we've seen the success of the Springboks and how they've done. Granted, they have power that perhaps we will never be able to imagine in an Irish sense.
Yeah.
And we spoke about it a little bit yesterday morning when we did our rugby with Louise and Alan as well, about perhaps a little bit of a disconnect in terms of how Irish rugby is thinking about how they play. Like, is a Springbok player who's just been part of that Razzie Erasmus bulldozing win to a World Cup part of a team that, say, Stuart Lancaster could coach at the moment? I would say no. I would say it's a different sort of player. Like, their imports have been the likes of James Lowe, who's been extremely successful. It allows flair in amongst their ranks, whereas what they're doing in Munster is very different, and perhaps that's great, the variety within the provinces, or perhaps that's a reason why maybe the Irish national team has got caught between two places, or have looked like they haven't had a plan B. But just on Munster is kind of the singular kind of thing that is Munster's success now, or their inevitable success when this happens. I think this is an absolutely huge signing. I think it's the biggest signing that an Irish province have made since Christian Ileifano went to Ulster. Granted, that was only, 2 years ago at this point, but it seems a long time ago now. And granted, he's not going to come until next year. And Snyman is a big addition as well. Snyman, I find both of them kind of, it does fly in the face of the idea that Munster will try and promote from within. Now, I know they haven't explicitly said that. They will always say that their number one priority is to get Backham in the Heineken Cup again. And this will give them every chance of doing that. Like, I think in the second row, if you're looking at the likes of Sean Klein and Tadhg Byrne, they're pretty well set in that position. But I'd like to hear the thoughts of some of their younger centres. Like, for example, what does Rory Scannell think of this signing? That being said, if you're any player in any team in Europe now and you go up against a midfield of Demian Deolande and Chris Farrell, you're terrified immediately because they're going to batter you.
Absolutely.
And they've picked the Springbok way now, Munster. I've got no issue with that. I think that if you're going to pick a winning style, it's just won a World Cup, all well and good. But if they want to promote from within, this is obviously going to raise a few eyebrows within the camp. But like, not in a hugely negative way. Like, there is also kind of the sense that, is Deolande's brilliance going to allow the younger players to look at him and actually develop from that? So that's what I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, you look at it, like, you don't really realise how many South African players are down there until they're listed out in front of you. Like, there are a lot. So there is that kind of power game, as you say, relative to, say, the Munster or the Leinster game, which is obviously a bit more finesse with the way, as you say, Lancaster.
And there are a few of them leaving, I should say as well. So, like, it's, I don't, like, when I say there, it might raise a few eyebrows. I'm just kind of being devil's advocate about it a small bit, rather than saying I think this is good news. Maybe I've got my Munster cap on there. I think this is very good news.
Well, I think probably, you know, the question over the last number of years has been obviously the IRFU with regard to the employment of foreign players and had the promotion, and then, you know, sending Carberry down there and all this kind of thing. So Schmidt was very much, it was led to believe, which I can't argue, is that he had very much a hand in all of that. As in, okay, we want this guy to get games, so he's going to go there. We want this guy to get this and whatever it is. So they were shifting around. So I would feel that probably Munster, who are a very, very proud province and a proud team, probably said, you know what, we're being told what to do rather than necessarily our own franchise deciding what's best for us, you know, and they haven't really been near it in the last number of years. So is this a slight bit of a change? You know, is it a bit of a pullback away from this central kind of authority who are deciding, well, he's going to go there, you're going to go here, we need a guy there because this is the style of play we want to, you know, to have for the Irish team? I don't know. You know, maybe it is a slight movement away. Maybe it's a little bit more autonomy for the actual provinces themselves in the sense of, well, we actually want to go for this style of play and we're going to play this style of play. Whether that suits Ireland, it doesn't really make a difference. We're going to play this style of play because it suits us.
Yeah.
And we'll feed that into the players that we see coming through. I think on the Deolande thing, I think if you're a 21, 22-year-old, what better? Who better to learn
from? It's true, in fairness, like, especially if Munster is now going to become the province where there is going to be a rotating cast of perhaps South African coaches. And if this is the way you want to play, if you are going to play your game based on power, which is no bad thing, because half the time it's lashing rain, it's shy conditions, it's not exactly conducive in the Pro 14 to throw the ball around all that much. So I've got no issue with that. But if that is what they want to do, then of course it's a fantastic signing.
Well, there's one thing this World Cup has taught me. Like, I mean, it's you could, you know, a blind person could, if you're not winning it up front, you're not going to win the game.
Yeah, it's as simple as that.
Yes. And like, I mean, and it's a very simple thing. I'm sure rugby people are saying, well, that's an idiotic thing to say. But it genuinely, like, I mean, you know, England in the semi-final won it up front. they played New Zealand, you know, tactically off. They did what they needed to do. And when they came up against South Africa went, well, we know exactly what you're going to do. You're trying to go to bash us, and we'll actually just outsmart you in that front. And then they lost the game. You know, they couldn't. So there's nuances in the back line and all that different stuff. But this is an agricultural way of looking at it. And if you are power and pace and all that stuff and offloading, you have to have the ball first. And if your forwards don't have it, and they aren't able to hold on to it, and they're going backwards, which England were in scrum-wise and line-out-wise and all that stuff, you're going to be under pressure.
Yeah, I think Irish rugby is often just crying out for a player who could make a few yards out of nothing. So it's something that, like, Manu Tuilagi can do, or something that Damien Deolande can do, and it's like...
Yeah, and I think, again, it's players. Like, you know, I could only imagine the New Zealand guys... Like, I know I haven't spoken to you much about, but my abiding memory of our loss in New Zealand was Stander getting that ball after about 2 or 3 minutes, and he sticks it under his shoulder, and it's like, oh, here, what's he going to try to do? He's going to try run at two guys in front of him who happened to be Whitelock and Reid, who just went, okay, he's going to run at us, and they stripped the ball, and they got the penalty. And literally in that small moment, it was like, okay, they're not going to bring anything new to this, Ireland, and we know, we have their number. Mm. And you were kind of like, it was nearly like, okay, the game's right there. So, you know, I think Ireland aren't the biggest. You know, physically, you know, we're just not that big. We're not as big as the South Africans. So I think the challenge for Farrell, for 4 years or whatever it is, or whoever's coming in after that or whatever it is, and this is what you're probably seeing with Lancaster, and this is why it's strange with Smith, considering what he did with Leinster, is our ability to outthink teams, you know, and to try different things, be it in our back line or whatever it is, to be a bit smarter, and to play the game, you know, a bit smarter, and probably to use, you know, to go with where our strengths are. And I don't think this bash game that we had, you know, everyone said, oh, we blew England apart a number of years ago. Yeah, we may have, but last year we didn't blow England apart. Yeah. They blew us apart. So anyway, I'm sure the rugby has been, which it has been, you know, talked about inside out. But anyway, they're two good signings, and you can imagine that Munster will be, as you say, with Farrell and Deolande in the centre.
Well, I'd be interested to see if this is kind of the start of things to come. Like, again, just to stress that there is possibly a gap opening up here. I think it's like there are South Africans leaving the province over the next couple of years, and these are being signed to replace them. This is not just kind of a pile-up of players.
Yeah.
And instead of perhaps signing your CJ Sanders or your potential project player, because now you've got to be in the country for 5 years instead of 3 years to play for Ireland, are the IRFU now saying, well, screw that, it's just too long, go and sign whoever you want. I don't care.
I think it could be.
Saying, I don't care if they're,
I think
they don't
care,
they can't play for Ireland. The Racing Post... this morning obviously doesn't carry anything from the Melbourne Cup, but we will get to that with Joseph O'Brien in about 10 minutes' time. The back page is home comforts, rejuvenated blues can make most of Stamford Bridge surroundings. That being said, they don't have an amazing home record this season. They seem to be better on the road. Chelsea against Ajax is an 8 o'clock kickoff in the Champions League tonight.
Yeah, I've got the Herald here. Mane is no diver, says Klopp. Pool boss defensive striker, as you would imagine he would. And then Glenn Whelan is saying to Mick McCarthy, count me in. And story about Richard Keogh. Interesting to hear what your opinion is on this one. Poor old Richard Keogh being kicked to the curb by Derby, obviously after their late night fracas and boozy session. And, you know, I think what people are trying to say is that the two guys, the guy driving the car and the guy, I think, in the passenger seat who ran off, they're still with the club, whereas Keogh has obviously been sacked.
Yeah, and his agent, Kos Toffis, has said that he's in a bad way, Richard, at the moment, that there will be, of course, some sort of action taken against Derby's decision. Like, no matter what kind of side of defence you fall down on this, it's a situation where he's being treated differently to everybody else. Now, Derby County might come out and say, well, he's captain, he should have known better than everybody else, and that is why he gets treated to everybody else. But I'm not sure how much water that argument actually holds. So it's going to be a very interesting thing. You just get the sense that this is going to go on and on. Although Keogh was saying that he's going to come back and he is going to play, which is probably the sounds you want to be hearing at this point. And it's obviously good news from a purely welfare point of view for Richard Keogh as well. So not the end of this story,
no.
I dare say. It is that Sadio Mane story on the back of the Sun as well. Sadio Gaga, Klopp rages as Pep, at Pep, claims that Mane is a diver. Parrot set to swoop in, as we've already mentioned. You've got that Richard rocked by Axe story. Lamp's jackpot, says Andrew Dillon. Frank Lampard will splash the cash if Chelsea have their transfer ban lifted. CAS is hearing the Blues' appeal against a two-window suspension on November 20th. So the 20th of November is when we'll find out whether or not they can sign players in January. And Pell feels pressure. Manuel Pellegrini is under pressure for the first time in his 18-month reign over West Ham's mini-crisis. A run of six games without a win has turned a spotlight on the Hammers boss.
Yeah, I've got the Irish Daily Mail here. We need a fix. We certainly do. Ron Nogara basically was saying that Ireland have gone further back in the credibility stakes when it comes to our World Cup performances. Basically saying that we need to people need to find out what exactly went wrong. Well, I think that's the million-dollar question, I suppose. You know, and there's Cuireadh Gary Ringrose looking slightly depressed as he gets his head bandaged. That's a wrap for Ringrose. Like, you know, I don't know. Those guys are obviously back. That is a tough ask. Back into training. The weather yesterday. You can only imagine heading out onto the park yesterday. Lashing rain, cold. You're just going, oh. After being, you know, 6 weeks in Japan and the confines of all of that and what went before it with the rugby camps in Carlton House and wherever else. Like, it's probably been practically 6 months of just intense, you know, just, oh, I can only imagine. It's not a nice place to be. Of course, it's great when things start to work out for you, but it's just every Irish player looked like they had a scowl on their face. No one looked happy to me. And I can only imagine. Maybe sometimes it's like when you kind of leave an inter-county setup. Trust me, I was in a number of them. And it's near your relief to go back to the club. You know, you're back to the club, you're back to pals, and you just kind of forget about it, and you just kind of get on, get back kind of in love with football again. Maybe that's the way it's going to be for them with regard to club rugby, but only time will tell. But it's going to be pretty hectic, obviously, as they come into the Christmas period.
Yeah, definitely. My favourite picture this morning is on the back page of The Guardian. Anything to declare, they ask. Eddie Jones gave no clues about his future as coach when England arrived back in London. After finishing World Cup runners-up. You've also got Settle Up or Face Ban. Cardiff ordered to pay Nantes £5.2 million, first instalment for Salah. Eddie Jones, good or a bad World Cup? For the man, I would have thought that most English people would come away saying job well done and kind of reevaluate to a point, but they just got caught cold. They played their final the week before, to use that horrible cliche, but it seems that was the case.
I think so. I'm a Jones fan. You know, I think some people, you either like him or loathe him and all that stuff, but I'm a fan of his. I think that he, you know, the big thing for me with Jones in England was the fact of, you know, I think he was fifth out of sixth in the 2018 Six Nations, so only Italy below them, I think. And he said, listen, don't judge me on this, judge me on the World Cup. I think he had to win, I think it was the last game on the Australian tour, where they had lost five in a row. He was under serious pressure. But, like, he never, ever really showed that pressure to me. His stance was always like, listen, I'm going to get this right, and this team is going to go right. So his confidence, some people were saying, oh, is he an arrogant type of fella? I don't think it was arrogance. He knew he had to, there was this kind of brashness with the England team of sticking the chest out, the chariot and all that. But when you kind of scratched at it, it was quite brittle because they lost the likes of Martin Johnson and these kind of real leaders. He identified, obviously, Farrell as a person who not only wears it, but can play like a leader. Backed him, got a number of them in, like Otoje behind him and all that. And he embodied that himself. And I think that then eventually grew into the team. And even when they were being beaten, like I remember some of his interviews when Ireland smacked them that time, he was kind of saying, oh, yeah, well, you know, they got a few lucky. And it wasn't anything to do with that. But the whole rhetoric of his press conference was around, they got lucky, we'll get better. It was no real focus on Ireland. It was all about, listen, he was building them up already. You know, you can imagine what he was saying to the players. And I think they just got cut cold. I think they genuinely got cut cold. I think he probably need to make some decisions from the Flood and the Farrell, the partnership of whether he needed to
Ford
change
Farrell,
that up
yeah.
a bit, or Ford and Farrell, whether he needed to change that up a bit with Slade and stuff like that. And I think he probably, kind of like Schmidt to a certain degree, went, it's tried and tested, I'm going to go with it, we can change it. And then I think from the start, it was quite evident that South Africa, I think, again, had their number and had them worked out and just played it very much attritional with the scrum, etc., etc.
Yeah.
And I think they were unlucky as well. Like Sinclair being like he was some player for them. Like he had an unbelievable World Cup, and his injury actually really knocked them. You could see them all kind of saying, because it's funny when you know a guy is going really well, and you see him go off, you're just going to go, oh, you know, inside. You know, you're not the next guy's coming in. You're going great, but you know he's not. The man is just gone
especially
off.
When you've got full 77 minutes ahead of you.
Absolutely.
We're just going to quickly round up the rest of the papers. The Irish Times leads with the hockey. It's not just a dream anymore. It's real. They have done it. And Carlow clubs lead the way in vintage hurling decade. St Mullins' win over Coole, that was the latest landmark for the game in the county. And then Sean Moran's got a line from last night's county board in camera meeting in Mayo. Mayo meeting camera amidst further questions. Tim O'Leary's fundraising foundation spells out issue in advance of meeting. Not a whole pile of progress being made there is the bottom line.
Just keeps giving though. Oh, that one.
What a story.
It's going to come. The Supermax one is still rumbling around. The Daily Telegraph has Joe Marler with the biggest I've ever seen of a neck pillow. That's probably just, I suppose, typical of the size of him. So that's his neck pillow that he likes to brandish on the plane coming home.
He is on the back page of the London Times as well this morning. Big lad. Big pillow for the plane is their caption. And an interesting story here from Matt Lawton. Farah's old samples may be retested. WADA to investigate all of Salazar's Nike athletes. This is a possibility now that's emerged. Sir Craig Reedy confirming to the Times that doping bans for the Oregon Project coach Alberto Salazar and Dr. Jeffrey Brown will now be followed by a detailed inquiry into the athletes who worked under their guidance at the Nike headquarters. So that could involve retesting old samples. So it'll be interesting to see how that story develops over the next couple of weeks. It is 8 o'clock on this Tuesday morning. You're watching OTBAM, and we've got plenty coming up over the next hour with racing. We've got Champions League, and we've got our GEA football team of the decade. Next, though, we'll be speaking to Joseph O'Brien. But before that, here is Andy Lee talking Katie Taylor.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station. OTB Gold, the very best of off the ball.
Are you crazy?
This is OTB Sports Radio. This week on OTB Gold.
Everybody participated. There was not one single clean rider or clean team in that race.
When kids on the street used to ask me, "Where's your dad from?" I used to say he was a dub. I just didn't want to be different. Right. I didn't want to be seen as Chinese.
I said I want to be as great an athlete as I can be, and I can't be that here.
Rory goes and wins the Grand Slam. Fair play to Rory. He's had a great career, but I still had a great career with three.
The players that aren't in the team in the starting 11, they're the ones you need to rely on through the season now and again. They're the ones, and Alex Ferguson could do it. He could keep a squad of 20, 22, 23 players happy.
OTB Gold, the very best of off the ball. Weekdays from 1 p.m. and 6 p.m. This is OTB Sports Radio. OTB AM.
I was listening to Steve Bunce today, and he like hit the nail on the head. When she was announced the winner and she was doing her interview, the reception she got, it was a special moment. It was like a new era in female boxing.
I was listening to the crowd. The one thing you can kind of notice about the different compositions of crowds and who's popular where and in front of what crowd, etc., there was a noticeably higher pitch to the cheering. and I mean that with all due respect. There was a lot more women seemingly in the arena that
and
night.
Young
and
girls.
Younger people as well.
Yeah, younger girls with signs and banners and flags. And
it was fantastic,
Like, it's just, like, I don't know. It was, and it is a real shift, like, for an Irish, even just, regardless, an Irish fighter fighting in England, to get that reception. It was better than the main event, you know, the crawl I got, and that was supposed to
which
be.
Which is saying something.
Yeah, he's a Manchester fighter in Manchester, and it was his going away party. But there was just as many people there to see Katie, and I even think the people who were there to see Krolla appreciated what she did in the ring, and everyone was on their feet.
There seems to be that more and more about the cards that she's on, and that you think of the couple of ones that she was thrown into, say in Cardiff, or where she's in the middle of the card, people are still filtering in. There's a lot of that. There's a definite sense that people are there to see her now.
Oh no, she's an attraction now. She's a draw, and it's only going to increase. Like, she's gotten to the point now where every fight is going to be against another champion or somebody who's a major rival or a major threat. So every fight's going to be a headline card now. You know, there's talk of having a pay-per-view headline fight next year. Yeah, and that will be a real statement.
Yeah.
Southern France and downdraft.
of reality at the top of the straight, went for home at the 400 metres. Vow and Declare back to the inside, two lengths Prince of Arran, then came Hunting Horn, Il Paradiso, late Master of Reality with Vow and Declare on the inside, then Prince of Arran, Raymond Tusk, Finch, it's Master of Reality, Vow and Declare up on the inside, Vow and Declare, Prince of Arran is lifting late with Il Paradiso, Master of Reality just in front, Vow and Declare kicks, Vow and Declare's won it for Australia, they're on top of the world, beats Prince of Arran, Il Paradiso in a photo finish and Master of Reality, a classic cup.
Yes, so that was about 4 hours ago from the Melbourne Cup. Vow and Declare giving Australia a famous home win in that one. I'm delighted to say, though, that Joseph O'Brien joins us on the line this morning. Good morning to you, Joseph. How are things?
Hi, Owen. Good, thank you.
So, Master of Reality, your horse, who finished closest to the top in that race, beaten overnight. I presume it's disappointment, Joseph. Like, when you watched the race, it was a good win, obviously, beaten near the end, but then relegated to fourth overall afterwards. How does the whole scenario sit with you at the moment?
Yeah, no, listen, it was a fantastic run, Owen. Very proud of the horse and all the work that the lads with that KSA travelled down here with the horse for the last couple of weeks. We're very proud, obviously, got it to get beaten such a fine margin, but it was a fantastic run and we're delighted. We got demoted to fourth. There was a little bit of interference just before the line. And they're the rules in Australia. When you interfere with a horse, you get placed behind it. So we got pushed back to fourth, which obviously was disappointing. But like I say, ultimately, very proud of the performance of the horse and the guys. And looking forward to maybe we'll have another crack next year.
Right, so if that race took place over here, the interference wouldn't have been called out? Or how does the rule differ?
There would have been a result. There would have been an insurer's inquiry, but who knows what the outcome would be. I suppose when in certain element of when in Rome, that the stewards here deliberated and they listened to the jockeys and they came to their decision. So that's fair. However, their rules are. When we're here. We comply to them, and that's what happened. There was a little bump going to the line, and we got placed back to fourth. But like I say, ultimately, it was a fantastic run from the horse, and we're delighted.
Yeah, it certainly was. How did Frankie feel after that? I think he's been suspended now for a while for careless riding.
Frankie got a couple of days in the run. It was his 20th ride in the race, and he hasn't won it yet. So we were all hoping that today could be the day, but unfortunately, it wasn't to be. Gutted for him because we obviously got so close. But he'll be back to fight again.
As a trainer, when you're watching that coming down the home stretch, when you're in with a real shout of winning another Melbourne Cup, how do you feel? Is it nervous or do you have to keep cool in the head at that point?
No, obviously you're excited and nervous and the combination of all different things. I suppose with any sport at any level, the margins are very fine. And I know that I've known that you haven't won any race until you cross the line in front. So, yeah, like I say, in any sport, the margins are very fine between winning and losing, and unfortunately, we just came out on the wrong side of it today.
What is the Melbourne Cup like as an event? It's obviously something you've had great success in before, and perhaps now it's disappointment on this occasion, but obviously the scenes around Vow and Declare seemed incredible this morning. It seems like an unbelievable race meeting.
It's a huge occasion. There's almost 100,000 people there. They call it the race that stops the nation down here, and it's a bank holiday in Melbourne, and literally the city stops and goes racing. It's a fantastic occasion. It's a privilege to be able to take part in it, and I would advise anyone if they ever get an opportunity to come and go racing on the day to do so. It's a special occasion, and it's a privilege to take part, and luckily we were very lucky to win the race a few years ago.
Yeah, it's been some couple of days for you as well, Joseph. I mean, on a purely globe-trotting level, how do you feel? Are you still jet-lagged a bit going from the Breeders' Cup to the Melbourne Cup? It's an insane part of the flat season, isn't it?
It is, yeah. This time of year, we've plenty of travelling. We're very lucky that we have a great team of staff and a great team of lads at home and that they travel with the horses around the world when they're racing. I suppose it's been a fantastic week of sport for Irish people and Irish sports people, and we're very proud that we had a small part to play in that.
When it comes to the Breeders' Cup win, I think you're the youngest trainer to saddle a winner at a Breeders' Cup meeting. Does that sort of tag ever give you a bit of pride? Because I know it's been something that's always been said about you achieving so much so young as a trainer. I know it's been only a couple of days and you had to get to Melbourne immediately afterwards almost, so you probably haven't had time to soak it in. But after a couple of days, how do you feel about that tag now?
Yeah, obviously it's very special to be the youngest trainer to win there. But I suppose I'm very lucky that I've been supported by some fantastic owners all over the world, and the Breeders' Cup is such a special meeting to be able to take part and to go over there is fantastic, and really to have a winner there was like a dream. It's literally the world stage of horse racing, and it's a very special weekend.
I think you were the youngest ever jockey to win at the Breeders' Cup as well. Was it? I suppose, I can't remember how many. I think you were 18 at the time when it happened a few years back at this point. So Breeders' Cup, it's obviously an event that means just as much to you as the Melbourne Cup. Getting abroad, well away from our shores, isn't something that's ever troubled you.
Yeah, no, I was very lucky to ride a winner there. I had only one winner, and I obviously would have rode there in a number of years. It's a very, very difficult place to go and compete. Obviously, the circumstances are so different, and the conditions are so different to what our horses are used to running at back in Ireland and in the UK. So it's a fantastic experience. It's a meeting that we look forward to every year, but It's not easy to come here or to go there and compete.
It wasn't a bad weekend for the family overall. Donica, of course, crowned Irish champion flat jockey. Have you been speaking to him? How happy is he to get that crown again?
Yeah, delighted. He's over the moon. He had a fantastic season. Himself and Colin Keane had a great battle all the way to the finish. Colin is a fantastic rider, and Donica just came out on top this year. He's had a great season, and I think he's going to take it easy for a couple of weeks. Obviously, he's quite tall and would have struggled with his weight, making weight pretty much every day all the last 3, 4, 5 weeks of the season. So he's going to take it easy for a couple of weeks, and it's well earned.
Yeah, because that would have been something that was in line with your career as a jockey as well. He's 21 years old at this point. I presume you're around the same height, and you obviously had a bit of trouble as well near the end of your career as a jockey in terms of making that weight. It is an unbelievably challenging part of the job.
It is, absolutely. I suppose both Dominic and myself are around 6 foot, and Dominic is riding at 125 pounds or 126 pounds day in, day out there all summer long. So obviously it's physically it's very draining, and mentally it's very draining as well. So but I suppose it's fantastic to be in the position to be able to ride some very good horses, and he'll have a well-earned break, and look forward to next year.
What do you do during that break? You've gone through it a couple of times when you've gone through a couple of months of particularly arduous making weight and trying to compete at the highest level. Is it just completely shackles off and not think about racing whatsoever, or how does a jockey behave during that time?
No, I don't know. I suppose they have to they have to keep an eye on their weight to a certain extent, because the heavier they get, the more weight they have to cut when they come back. But I suppose the most important thing is just to relax and mentally to get away from the stress and the day in, day out nature of the game, because it's very tough and there's lots of highs and lows, and I think just to relax and have a freshen up and come back with a clear mind.
Yeah, I think he mentioned AP and he mentioned Pat Smullen as well in the aftermath of getting that crown over the course of the weekend, saying that I just don't know how they managed to do it over such a long period of time. Like, obviously, it helps if you're not 6 foot tall, but what else is the key when it comes to actually having that mental fortitude to come back year after year after year right at the top of the game?
Yeah, it's a very tough job. The jockeys making weight every day. I suppose that's probably the hardest part of it. And the other side of it is the best jockeys in the world are probably riding to a 20-25% win strike rate. So almost 80% of the time they're losing. So mentally you never really feel like things are going that well, because you're losing way more often than you're winning. So it's tough physically and mentally. But we're very lucky in Ireland that I mean, some of the best horsemen and the best jockeys in the world have come from Ireland and are in Ireland, and we're very lucky to be able to see them compete day in, day out.
When you look back on 2019 as a whole, I'm not sure if you had time to reflect yet, what's the first thing that comes to mind? What's the biggest thing you've learned this year?
I suppose, personally, it's been a very good season. And the Breeders' Cup, obviously, is a highlight. But I'm just very lucky and very grateful that we have a very good team of lads and a team of staff at home on the hill in owning that make my job very easy. I've been supported by some fantastic owners from all over the world, and they've all sent me some lovely horses, and to be able to repay them with winners is what my job is. But I suppose I'm very proud of the team that we have at home, and the guys that have travelled with the horses, and the guys that do all the work day in, day out. Our success goes to them.
And like at the age of 26 now, Joseph, do you still feel it's the art of training something that you're working on as a craft? Do you still feel that you've got a long way to go, or do you kind of feel that you're happy where you're at the moment and you just need to do what you do better to try and get better, because I'm sure nobody is happy with where they're currently sitting?
No, I don't think anyone ever feels like they have got to a stage that they don't want to get better, and if they have, they probably need to change their mindset. We always want to improve. We want to do better next year than what we've done last year, and we'll continue to strive to do so every year. That's what it's all about, and that's why we get up in the morning and go to work, because we want to have a better season next year than last season.
Well, Joseph, hard luck again on last night, but congratulations on the great success over the weekend. Great to chat to you.
Thanks very much, Owen.
Joseph O'Brien there, live in the line from Australia this morning, talking about the Melbourne Cup. I'm not sure if you see it last night, Anthony, but it's up on YouTube for anybody who's missed it. It's an incredible finish, and obviously kind of tough on them to get demoted to fourth place after getting beaten on that. It's just kind of like rubbing salt in the wounds, but as you can hear there, no surprise whatsoever. He's taken it very graciously, Joseph O'Brien. So we're talking football next here on OTBAM, and last night we were in Dundalk with thanks to Virgin Media Sport. Keith Andrews, Niall Quinn and Damien Delaney joined Nathan on stage, and here is Delaney on the modern demands of defending and the age profile that is now necessary if you are to thrive there.
Good way to look at this. When you spoke earlier about teams bringing in young players, it's a young man's game now. You know, I mean, all these guys are 21, 22 years of age, and when these full backs are pushed in, the midfield players are pushed in, and the ball turns over and you go full press, if they beat the press with one pass, the centre back's job then all of a sudden is slow this down. Don't commit and quicken up the counter-attack. Slow it down. Because if you've got serious legs at full-back and you're 2'8 and you're 6, they're coming. And the statistics are the modern player can cover 10 metres a second. Right? So a player flat out in the pro zone stats is 10.1, 10.2 metres a second. So if you can slow a counter-attack down 1 or 2 seconds, that's 20 metres. And your players like Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold, my God, the cavalry will be coming very, very quick. So when they do beat the press, the centre-back's job or a sixth job isn't to go, oh my God, they beat the press, panic, make another bad decision, and now all of a sudden no one's getting back. Slow down, control it, get it wide, so you're buying yourself another couple of seconds because the cavalry will be coming.
I think it's just really keen to hear these things. I think that's what Van Dijk does. He almost slows down fast things that are happening, and he's buying time.
That's what it is, because the cavalry's coming.
Yeah, it's amazing. Because now you've described, I'll use it now, but I'll give you a bit of credit.
That's very interesting, though, Anthony, isn't it? The idea that the role of the centre half is as much to just slow people down for a split second.
Yeah, no, it is. It's actually, it's spot on. Actually, you know, when you think about it, like 10.1, 10.2 meters. That's what they're travelling at.
What would you cover in a second?
Listen, at least 4 or 5.
Right. Yeah. You can catch that.
I can slow someone down, though.
It's the most important thing. Apparently, that's Virgil van Dijk's biggest strength, it seems. You can get that full thing back on youtube.com/offtheball. It sounds like a fascinating chat. We are turning our attention, though, to tonight's Champions League action, and I'm delighted to say John Bruin is with us on the line. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Let's start by not talking about the Champions League, because that's exactly what Jurgen Klopp was not talking about in his pre-match press conference. It's all about Sadio Mane, John. Is he a diver, first of all?
I think, like many modern professionals, he is aware of the concepts of contact and will try and make the most of it when he can. Let's put it that way.
He's obviously a little bit irked by this, and he's kind of mystified by the idea that Pep Guardiola even had time in the aftermath of last weekend's 3 o'clock kickoffs to actually think about this, to actually hear about this, and then to subsequently make a public utterance about this. And he probably has a point. I mean, Klopp says his brain isn't big enough to think about the Manchester City game at that point, that he had a midweek fixture to worry about.
Yeah, I'm not sure I could quite get it on both sides. At one point, Jürgen Klopp appeared to suggest that he sometimes doesn't even know the other result, which I find very difficult to believe. But I don't suppose it would take much for, say, Pep Guardiola to be shown a picture of a Sadio Mane dive or a goal or something like that. I suppose the thing that does stand out for this is it is rare, and I've been casting my mind back to think of managers commenting on players diving in another match other than their own. Pep Guardiola, I don't know, did he break some kind of protocol in doing this? Because, I mean, we can all remember Jose Mourinho and Alex Ferguson saying these types of things in post-match after a game's been played, or maybe dropping something in ahead of playing a team, say in a Champions League game or a Premier League. But actually talking about another player playing in another game, that, okay, it's to do with you in the title race. That's, I actually couldn't believe that he'd said it at the time, and I wasn't quite sure that he'd actually said it about Mane, but that does appear to be the case. And in that sense, I think Klopp's entitled to be a little bit annoyed. I was quite surprised how much he went on about it in yesterday's press conference. But it just shows you, I mean, as you said, we're talking about the Champions League here, but that battle between Liverpool and Manchester City is taking the entire focus of, well, especially Liverpool. And it's beginning to look like the way he's talking Pep Guardiola as well.
Yeah, it's a good point there, John. We're just going to fix your camera for just a moment. But that is, like, it is true, the idea that, first of all, that there is midweek fixtures to get ready for, that it's not a match preview. And second of all, it's actually after a different match entirely that you're making these comments. It is, like, as John mentions there, a bit extraordinary that this has actually come up. Fair enough if it's 2 days before the actual game and you're like trying to play a few mind games. It seems that Pep is completely obsessed with Liverpool already.
Well, I'd say he obviously realises the threat that's there, and he's just taking every single opportunity he can to just have a go. And you know what, it might even be just someone actually in his ear saying, by the way, this happened, do you want to say something about it? And he said, yeah, well, listen, yeah, just put something out there. You know, it doesn't take a whole lot, you know, really. Yeah, you can, you know, to look at the incident, 15 seconds. You know, so I, you know, Klopp is trying to say, like, you know, Klopp is trying to give this, you know, this opinion of, well, I don't really think about you, but you can be damn sure that Klopp is thinking about them constantly as well, and will take any opportunity that he gets now to have a go.
Yeah.
So, you know, but like, it's, I think the underlying current obviously is that Guardiola obviously realizes, you know, he's under a bit of pressure. He realises, and he's trying everything that he can to try and win the mind game battle.
Yeah, it seems, John, that Pep has become, I don't want to say consumed by Liverpool, but in terms of kind of an opposition in his tenure as a Premier League manager, this is obviously the biggest opposition beast he's ever had to come up against. And for a manager of his level of detail, you can't really be surprised that he's got this level of obsession about Liverpool.
No, not at all. And I suppose you've got to consider, I mean, the thing is, how many races has Pep Guardiola been involved in? There weren't too many in Germany. In fact, there were no title races it was involved in. Bayern just cruised to it. Manchester City in his first season finished fourth, were way off the title race when Chelsea blazed to the league. So that rivalry between him and Jürgen Klopp is the first he's had since that rivalry with Jose Mourinho back in 2011-12. But what you've got there, and if you look back to that, that was a time when it was widely said, wasn't it, that Pep Guardiola struggled with that rivalry. That he took a year out of football after that. He couldn't cope with it. I don't think anyone could doubt that pressure gets to Pep Guardiola. I definitely say he thrives on pressure. I mean, look back on that Amazon documentary that they did a year or two ago And this is a guy that gets brutally intense over a game against Burton Albion. So you've got them playing Liverpool, and this is the best Liverpool team for 30 years, and a team that really do have the whip hand in the title race. It's just, we don't expect mind games to come in the first weeks of November, do we?
No, it's true. It's almost as if Guardiola is conscious that he needs to completely blow his mind in terms of focusing on an opposition, because that is the only way he can achieve peak Pep. That is, like, he knows that eventually he's going to burn out, but he still has to do this thing. And maybe is this the first sign that Pep is close to that next stage of burnout, that he is close to that next stage where he does need to take a break again for a couple of years? Because there has been some signs and there has been some suggestions over the last couple of months that perhaps he is thinking that way.
Well, yeah, I mean, on a personal note, his wife moved back to Spain. Now, Manchester City tell us that nothing to worry about there. That's just a simple arrangement, you know, and that's not going to be, that's going to affect these contracts at Manchester City. But when things like that happen, and when Pep starts behaving in the way that he does, you do begin to wonder whether he might fancy another of those sabbaticals in New York. You know, all he gets to do, all he did there was, you know, play golf, dine out with Garry Kasparov. I think there's a chef from El Bulli, the Spanish restaurant. You know, live the life of the intelligentsia in New York, rather than have to worry about Sadio Mane's diving. So
it doesn't sound like a bad thing.
Well, if I was Pep Guardiola and I'd earned, you know, rumoured, I was reading Private Eye and they said he'd earned something like £20 million a year, then, you know, you can go to New York and you can think about Catalan independence there, rather than having to worry about whether, he can fit Nicolas Otamendi in his team. The way that Pep Guardiola drives himself, it's apparent to all of us. You know, there's that thing that he doesn't eat on the day of the game, and, you know, he becomes wraith-like. And look at the way that he kicked off with John Stones when John Stones didn't have his gear on the other day. The pressure's getting to him, but as you said, he does really... that it's all about it for Pep, and it is that point where he will burn out. And if anyone's going to burn him out at the moment, it could be Liverpool.
Like, you mentioned the Jose Mourinho Pep Guardiola rivalry previously. It was absolutely epic. It seems to me that you couldn't pick two further apart managers in their philosophy, and especially in terms of how they treat their players, than Jurgen Klopp and Jose Mourinho. But is there some sort of common thread at all there, John, that does irk Pep, or that does have an ability to get Pep wound up a little bit between Klopp and Jose?
Well, I think you'll find that these managers don't like other managers who might be as good as them. Mm. Now, Jose Mourinho and Jurgen Klopp are not especially close. But last season it did seem to be reasonably sporting. It wasn't a Fergie v Wenger situation at all. And it was probably the best title race since back in those days. But I suppose the Fergie v Wenger thing, that went on over a few years, and certain theatres of war are open between the two. And then you've got this situation where when players are seen to dive, that becomes something that you can pick on. Pep Guardiola, I mean, OK, all these big managers are slightly petulant there. They've got big egos. Pep Guardiola, in the press conference situation, there is something of the bottom lip stuck out quite a lot of the time, isn't there? There's a slightly childish element to him at times, and the way that he deals with the media, and the way he deals with questions he thinks are not the type of question that someone like Pep Guardiola should have to be answering. I think with Klopp is quite similar, and I think that may be it. They're both are very driven people. Both of them have a finite lifespan as manager. I mean, Klopp did 7 years at Mainz, 7 years at Dortmund, and I suppose we're coming up to 4 years at the club now. Could you really see Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool in 5 years? Probably not, because of the intensity with which he drives himself. So they're essentially turning the intensity that they have on each other at the moment And more of it, I say. More of it. It's been good fun.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually, the bottom lip out sort of manager that Fergie and Wenger were, you know, if they're pissed off with you, they'll let you know. Whereas with Klopp and Pep, it might be kind of the polite smile, but inside they're raging, that if perhaps they kind of wore more anger on their sleeve, we would have slices of pizza thrown in the tunnel and we would have captains going toe-to-toe in the tunnel, but perhaps it's all being kept inside the dressing room and perhaps that's how they like it. Just before we move on, I presume Genk tonight at Anfield, Johnny, don't see any issue for Liverpool. I was actually reading this week that Jurgen Klopp's been practicing going down in training, that they've been practicing 3-1 down situations where they might go 2 men down in training as well, and that is kind of the preparation for the comebacks that they've had in recent weeks. But I don't imagine they're actually kind of making any predictions that are going to go down against Genk tonight.
No, I don't think so. I think the Champions League almost is, for Liverpool and City in particular, have got such an easy draw. Mm. It's something of a rest home for them, really. I mean, Liverpool suffered their only defeat of the season in the Champions League, but it's still not going to affect them going through. Nice and easy for Liverpool. You've got to say that, haven't you?
Yeah, for sure. Chelsea against Ajax, one of the fixtures of the night. It's it's actually a brilliant night's football. Like, outside of that, you don't really have an early fixture that stands out. You got Barcelona against Slavia Prague at 5:55. Zenit against RB Leipzig is the other game at 5:55. Liverpool against Genk, as we mentioned already, at 8:00. And then Dortmund against Inter Milan at 8:00. But Chelsea against Ajax is just where we want to finish up in terms of tonight's previews, John. And you look at all the things that have been written about Chelsea. You look at what Frank Lampard has been saying and his philosophy and the young players, and you wonder if this is the most likeable Chelsea has ever been under Roman Abramovich or during the Roman Abramovich era.
Well, yeah, I was thinking about this. Do you remember Sexy Football and Ruud Gullit?
Yes.
I mean, when's that? 1996, 97, 98, that time?
98, yeah. I was actually watching it on Premiership Years the other day, John. Great timing, yeah. Sexy Football is all that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Chelsea were the entertainers of the Premier League back then, and it hasn't been that way. And that's the thing about Roman Abramovich, is that we're told through those that pertain to know him that he's always wanted Chelsea to play that Barcelona style of play. There was, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, there was that point where he was trying to build a team and it looked like to tempt Guardiola to Chelsea when he started stacking up playmakers, Juan Mata and Oscar and Eden Hazard. And then he ended up with Rafa Benitez. But there you go. But yeah, and now you've got Frank Lampard, who is someone who... his Derby team last season were great to watch in the Championship. He's taken a hell of a step up. But Chelsea are playing football that, yeah, you'd switch your TV on to watch. And there will always be something exciting about having young players play for the club that brought them through. And I don't know a month ago or so, when Kante got injured playing for France and Frank Lampard was very annoyed about this, we thought about how it might affect Chelsea, but they haven't missed him at all. Slightly leaky at the back, but that's what a lot of entertaining teams are. And all credit to Frank Lampard. He's done a great job so far this season.
Are you surprised with how effective the duo of Kovacic and Jorginho has been this season? Because they were signed as Maurizio Sarri duo. They were assigned to be the practitioners of Sarri ball. And Frank Lampard has left to pick up the pieces in midfield and has done a better job than the manager who wanted these midfielders in there. So it is all credit towards the young players that he's brought through and had great success with. I think the midfield success that they've had, that is a huge thing that Frank Lampard has managed to achieve this season.
Yes, yeah, it is. I think with Sarri, in Italian football, Sarri is probably considered a free spirit in the way that he runs his teams, but in English football, well, maybe not so much. And you remember, of course, that Manchester City wanted to buy Jorginho. Pep Guardiola was very annoyed that he didn't get him. And when he was playing for Chelsea last season, you thought, why would Pep Guardiola want this player who is so one-dimensional within his team? But Frank Lampard's brought something out of him He supplied an assist at the weekend, which was something he didn't manage to do last season. And you've got a player there of real talent. And when you don't make him the focus of the team in the sense that Sarri had him having the ball almost all of the time, then you've got a player whose change of angles and passing ability is great for a team of young players of such speed. And Kovacic, you know, 2 or 3 years ago was regarded as such a player of such high talent. Mm. Yet when he turned up at Chelsea, you began to wonder what exactly he was there for. He was just one of these sort of players that's part of a process. But yet again, Frank Lampard has changed him, and it's just adding that element of freedom, that ability to improvise. And I suppose there may come a point where that ability to improvise counts against Chelsea. But for the moment, those players are enjoying themselves, enjoying the freedom. And I'm not sure I would have ever thought that Frank Lampard would be a laissez-faire, off-the-cuff manager, but that's who he's proved to be so far.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. Just before we let you go, John, speaking of managers you don't expect to be laissez-faire, Jose Mourinho to Arsenal, potentially the greatest rumour of this season, in my view. You were writing over the course of the weekend about this, saying that it's not a good idea. But, John, I put it to you this way. What about the Arsenal fan TV videos when Jose Mourinho's win or a tenure starts to go sour at Arsenal? That would be Oscar-worthy cinema right there.
It would, it would. I mean, just look at the way that it went at Manchester United. The one thing you would say about Mourinho is that he managed to divide fans hugely at that club to the point where it was, I'm for Mourinho, he's right about this club, and other fans saying, well, I can't stand the style of football, I can't stand this guy. And if you aren't a Manchester United fan, that was great entertainment. The problem is that we've forgotten about Jose Mourinho as the winning machine he was, up until he left Inter Milan, really. The problem for Jose Mourinho is that the coach that he was 12, 13 years ago is exactly the type of manager that clubs like Arsenal, Bayern Munich, you name it, AC Milan, would want. But unfortunately, that guy's not around anymore. Instead, we've got Jose Mourinho, a footballing conservative, a guy who doesn't seem to want to build a team in the way that he did at Porto and Chelsea. And in the way that he probably would have to at Arsenal, he just wants to arrive, be given 500 million, prove his brilliance by winning the league and the Champions League. It's not really going to happen for him. That story, that link of him with Arsenal last week, I mean, it was predictable, and it came from well-placed sources and journalists, but Arsenal's dismiss of it, the fact that they said that This purported meal between Jose Mourinho and the director, Raul Sinelli, had not happened. That really puts the kibosh in it. And to me, that's disappointing because, like you, that would have been great fun to see. And if you ask me, Arsenal Fan TV needs a bit of a pep up. The lads are getting a bit tired these days with the material. Yeah, let's get him in.
Couldn't agree more, John. They need something new. So get Jose into the Emirates Stadium immediately. John Bruin, thanks a million.
Cheers.
It is 8:36 on this Tuesday morning. You're watching OTBAM, the sports show from Off the Ball, the sports breakfast show, no less, from Off the Ball. The podcast will be available afterwards to download on iTunes and Spotify or on the Go Loud app. And you can listen back to John there if you're just joining us. The papers this morning with Anthony Moyles. Joseph O'Brien was with us later on. We will still have Hector O'Hyokagon joining us later on and our football team of the decade discussion that's coming up before 9 a.m. this morning. Next, though, we've got Tom Malone in studio. But before we've got our roadshow in Dundalk last night, Niall Quinn was talking about the importance of the company you keep.
We used to have this exercise, and think about it now, say six of you around and the two lads in the middle, you throw a ball up in the air and you've got to win the header. And in the end, you know, it's just getting stupid. You're doing haymakers on each other. And, you know, it always ended up, and they used to do it, they used to laugh. Quinny and Martin, you go in and go, oh, here we go. And you know you're getting it, so you have to do it, you know. And it's just great. And eventually it goes too far and we were getting sent in all the time. But stuff, training was barbaric. And like the lads won't even believe me. Like, you know, it was colour TV now. I'm not back in the black and white days, but I was a long time ago. But at Arsenal, when I was a kid, you did your training in the morning, you did all that, and then you were always in the afternoon, and you got a voucher to go down to the fish and chip shop for a pie, chips and a Coke.
and then running around the afternoon, you know, you're kind of... it was just a different time. And I used to drink a lot and all the rest of it. You know, you played snooker, went to the bookies and drank, right? That was the life of a footballer then. And I goes, how did you... Everyone was doing it, you know? Every club was doing it. You know, you'd go out somewhere and you'd find all the lads from Spurs or all the young lads from QPR would be there. And it was just the culture at the time. And sure, I joined in. Who was I to change it, you know?
Joined in or led the way?
I did about... I remember my mother telling me the most important thing I'll do is, you know, you'll have a couple of friends, pick good friends. And my two were Tony Adams and Paul Merson.
Niall Quinn there at last night's Virgin Media Roadshow in Dundalk. The full piece is available up now on youtube.com/offtheball. Tom Malone is with us in studio. How are you?
Yeah, good, good.
Bleary-eyed after the Melbourne
Cup.
Yeah,
pretty bleary-eyed. I was nearly late this morning because I got up for the Melbourne Cup and then fell back asleep.
What time was
it?
4 a.m. was it?
Yeah, 4. So it wasn't actually that weird a time to get up for me anyway, but yeah, I ended up falling back asleep in the cage. It wasn't ideal, but what a finish.
Yeah, it seems like, does that go down as one of the better Melbourne Cup finishes over the last few years?
It's probably best for the race that there was an Australian winner because we've had an European 1-2-3 for the last couple of years. So, right. Yes, we had a European 2-3-4, but, you know, for the Aussies to take it, we had 7 Irish-trained runners in the race, effectively 11, because if you look back, you know, the likes of Mustajir and a couple of others had been trained in Ireland up until a couple of months ago, and then they were bought by Aussie trainers. So, you know, 11 of the 24, effectively 4 months ago, were trained in Ireland. And you look at something like the Vintage Crop Stakes in Navan, where the first four home in what's a kind of a nothing staying race in Navan in April, and the first four home in that all lined up again in the Melbourne Cup. Right. So the European pattern for staying races is incredibly important for warming up for the Melbourne Cup. With such an amount of prize money on offer, it's kind of unignorable. So
how much is it?
I think it's about $5 million or something like that.
So but get yourself down to Navan in springtime, really, to
Absolutely. Well, if you're looking to sell your horse to Australia for big bucks, definitely get them lined up in the vintage crop at Navan. Yeah.
Who would have known?
That would have been extraordinary had Joseph O'Brien managed to do Breeders' Cup, Melbourne Cup, double in the space of a couple of days.
Absolutely incredible. I mean, the guy kind of redefines the term precocious. He only rode for a couple of years. He was a dual champion jockey. He was a teenager when he rode his first Classic winner. He's the youngest person to ever ride a Breeders' Cup winner with Sir Nicholas Abbey in 2011. He's the youngest man to ever train a Breeders' Cup winner. Only 4 Irish people have ever trained Breeders' Cup winners. Aidan O'Brien, Vincent O'Brien, Joseph O'Brien and John Ox. He's the youngest trainer to ever have a Melbourne Cup winner. If Master Reality had come out on top, he'd only be the second European to ever win the Breeders' Cup twice after Dermot Weld.
All at the age of 26.
And he's only 26. You know what I mean? His dad only turned 50
we
the other
all
week.
Hang our heads and shame.
Yeah. And like his brother Dunica became dual champion on Sunday. He is kind of going to dip. He's dipping his toe in the training ranks. He will become a trainer, whether it's this year or next. As you heard from the chat, you know, he's struggling with his weight as well. He's even taller than Joseph.
Yeah, 6 foot for a jockey. That's incredible.
He's even taller than Joseph. There's actually a picture on my Instagram of me interviewing Dunica, and he's a good 2 inches taller than me.
Right. What do you say, 125, 126 pounds?
He's riding at 9 stone, that's kind ridiculous. Of week in, week out.
That's really, you know, really tough.
Yeah.
You know, it's an incredible struggle, and I know some of the stuff Joseph used to go through to keep his weight intact, and I think Joseph was probably a little bit more disciplined than Dunica, but you know, the two of them have done incredibly well to keep their weight intact. And like I said, both dual champion jockeys, and like I said, you know, Joseph has jumpers as well. He's had Cheltenham Festival winners, he's had 5 Grade 1 winners over jumps as well. So it's not just a case where, oh, now, you know, it's come to the winter, he can gear down. He's a full, you know, stable of horses for the likes of JP McManus, other horses who will be Grade 1 contenders over the course of the winter as well. So he doesn't get a break.
No.
You know what I mean? He's got another 100 jumpers to keep an eye on that will be targeted at the spring festivals. They're not, you know, he's not going to, you know, Perlis on a Thursday for handicap hurdles. Like he'll be there to compete in all the big Grade Ones over the course of the season.
What's going on this morning, Tom?
Yeah, well, you mentioned the Melbourne Cup. Obviously, Vow and Declare won. Joseph's horse finished second there, just touched off, was eventually demoted to third. But it was the European trained 2-3-4, Prince of Aaron second, Il Paradiso third, and Master Reality demoted from second to fourth. Let's move on to the football. Liverpool goalkeeper Alisson is adamant that Sadio Mane is not a diver. Manchester City boss Pep Guardiola criticised the forward ahead of the crucial Premier League game on Sunday, but Alisson has defended his teammate.
We think that Sadio is a top player. We know him, we know his capacity. He is a top player, and he is really, really important for our team. And he showed this in the last game with an assist and scoring a goal.
Liverpool will look to make back-to-back wins over Genk in Group E in the Champions League at Anfield later. In the other game in that group, Napoli, of course, the only team to beat Liverpool this season. They take on Salzburg. While in Group H, Chelsea will look to continue their good run of form and look to do the double over Ajax at Stamford Bridge. Boss Frank Lampard wants his team to keep the focus and maintain that good run.
At this level, if you don't, you're not going to get the results. So it's very much a case of not getting away from ourselves in this group and getting the wins to hopefully get us through.
Well, in the other game in that group, Valencia play Lille at the Mestalla. Elsewhere around the groups in the Champions League, in Group F, Barcelona looking to bounce back from that loss to Levante at the weekend. They host Slavia Prague, while Borussia Dortmund will seek a bit of revenge when they take on Inter Milan. In Group G, it's Zenit St. Petersburg to face top of the pool Leipzig, which is probably a bit of a surprise that Leipzig are top of that pool at the moment, and Lyon up against Benfica. While there's been a positive injury update from Republic of Ireland boss Mick McCarthy, he's updated on the fitness of Glenn Whelan, Darren Randolph and Matt Doherty ahead of Monday week's Euro 2020 showdown with the Danes in Dublin. McCarthy also confirmed that he will include Tottenham teenager Troy Parrott in his squad alongside Aaron Connolly. Of course, they play New Zealand as well in a friendly next week. Well, Tottenham Hotspur have revealed that they will appeal the red card handed to Son Heung-min after Sunday's Premier League game against Everton. The South Korean put in a challenge on Andre Gomez, of course, leading to the Portuguese player breaking his ankle pretty shockingly in that game. Son was left in tears after that tackle, and he may not travel to Belgrade for that Champions League match with Red Star tomorrow. And finally, Munster, of course, pulled off a transfer coup when they revealed they've signed South African World Cup winner Damian Deolande. 27-year-old centre will join on a 2-year deal.
Good stuff, Tom. We had Colin Boyle and David Moran on our Saturday panel last weekend. They were talking to Neil Tracy, and here they are on the advanced mark rule.
The advanced mark coming in next season, it was trialled earlier this year in the Allianz Football League. At the time, like Jack McCaffrey had been speaking about it. He says it's going to bring Gaelic football closer to Aussie rules and a little step towards a much more stop-start game. To quote him, he says, "One of my favourite players to watch at the moment is Conor Callan. Every time he gets the ball, he just turns and goes straight at you, and it could be a travesty if he was to turn into a player who just catches the ball and kicks it over the bar, which he can do, which he can do and will do, because it's a no-brainer essentially." What are your own thoughts on it? Would you think it will lead to a bit more stop-start like that?
Yeah, I'd be totally against it, to be honest. Yeah. Myself and David just had a brief conversation before, and I don't see the need for it. If you go back to this year's championship and the quality of football, you know, we've already talked about it, especially in the two finals. You know, would an advanced mark have improved the All-Ireland finals this year? Definitely not. It would have slowed the game down. Would it improve any of the club games that we're seeing at the minute that have been shown at the weekends? I don't think so. I think Jack McCaffrey's point there, a ball being kicked into a corner forward, him turning, even as a defender, him turning, taking on his man, maybe doing a dummy solo, dummy hop, or a defender stripping him with the ball, making a block down. I think they're the best elements of our game. And a player, you know, taking a handy mark, you know, in 20 yards of space and then turning, having maybe 10 or 15 seconds to take a shot at goal, you know, in time, teams will nearly become so good at utilising the mark that between marks and free kicks, it could turn into a glorified free kick competition.
Colin Boyle and David Moran there, speaking on the Saturday panel last week about the advanced mark. Not in favour, as you can hear, Colin Boyle, of that new rule, which was passed in Congress last month. You can get the full piece back on youtube.com/offtheball. That was one of the big stories of the winter. The biggest story of the GAA winter, though, is Off the Ball's team of the decade. Anthony Moyles has been picking his team. I've been picking my team. Tommy Rooney joins us in studio as a neutral observer. How are you, Tommy?
Well, lads.
You excited?
I'm going to be the referee here. Am I excited? I got your texts early this morning and late last night, and there's a couple of points of disagreement.
Oh, okay. Let's get straight into it.
Can you handle the pressure, Tommy?
I can handle the pressure.
This is a big event.
I feel like Buddy E felt the pressure last night.
Well, you know, those 3 minutes, I was sweating it.
See, he says 3 minutes. And then he's like, "Oh, and then I googled this, and then I was on this, and then I was like checking this, and then I was Colin Keyes was like this." I'd say he was
almost texting me in Japan. He was like, "Let's get Moisey in at the start of November, and we'll do the team of the decade."
Yeah. sitting there. I've been just mulling this over the last 6 weeks.
For 9 years.
You both have a couple of odd selections. I'll tell you that much before you get into them.
Well, do you want to list off your team from goalkeeper to corner forward?
No. I think you go. Are you going first?
Okay, I can go first if you want.
Yeah, you go first.
I've got nothing to hide here. Big shock in goal as I go for Stephen Cluxton. Full back line of Philly McMahon, Johnny Cooper and Keith Higgins. Half back line of Lee Keegan, James McCarthy and Jack McCaffrey. Brian Fenton and Michael Murphy. A bit of a talking point there perhaps in midfield, kind of shoehorning him in there to be quite honest with you. Jimmer Connolly, Kieran Kilkenny and Paul Flynn in the half forward line. Con O'Callaghan, Bernard Brogan and the Gooch is my full forward line.
A couple of very interesting developments. I think now, so we can get into a proper discussion, does Anthony reveal his team now as well?
Yeah, let's go for it. Go for it, Anthony. In case some of the things I think are controversial.
I'm going to change my team. Okay, so I went with Cluxton as well. Mark O'Shea, McCarthy, Keith Higgins, Keegan, O'Sullivan, Jack McCaffrey, Fenton, Murphy, same midfield partnership.
Okay.
Ryan McHugh, Aidan O'Shea, Kilkenny, the Gooch, Bernard Brogan, and...
like Manzi.
They're very different teams. I thought that Michael Murphy and Gooch would be the two that you would most heavily disagree with, but lo and behold, you've gone for them in the exact same positions. Let's start with the full back line. Gone for James McCarthy as your full back. Is that a shoehorning in?
It's a little bit of that. Okay. Yeah, it's a little bit of that. Because, you know, I suppose, you know, we discussed this earlier on. Full back was a tricky position, actually. Okay, Cooper. Yeah, there was Cooper or Philly, and I was bordering on Cooper. And then I looked at Graeme Canty at the start of the decade. Mm. Very, very strong player was your archetypal kind of fullback. McGee needs to probably be in the question.
He's in the mix, isn't he?
I think he won three All-Stars for, you know, fullback. So if you want to say, you know. But the way I looked at that was, and I think probably people at the time was, that was a defensive system, you know, more so than he was a... stereotypical full back, if you know what I mean. You know, so there was the defensive system that obviously Jim McGuinness brought in. So, so McCarthy was. I think Mark O'Shea has to be in there.
Just for pure aesthetics, why wouldn't you put Keane O'Sullivan at three and McCarthy at six?
I was thinking that.
This is actually really grinding my gears right now.
Because I think O'Sullivan completely altered the sixth position for Dublin. And I think for a long number of years, well, not for a long number of years, but when he was missing with hamstrings and when he was missing, when he went off a bit of the boil a bit, I think they struggled to fill that gap for them. And they actually had to change the way they played to actually say, well, he actually perfectly suited what we needed to do here. Because he did change. He was a pivotable player for them
in
15, 16, 17.
Three in a row at the start.
I think he was essential. And I think what he did was... He changed the position of six, because six was very much the type of thing where you either went with the 11 or you sat back in front. And essentially, he was a sweeper within the six role. You know, he was a sweeper within that setup, and he could cover off players. He was one of the types of guys who decided the tempo of the game. Like, more often than not, he would decide whether they were going to go hard at a team or hold on to the ball. A lot of calls went through him. And I think he was a guy that I think when he was missing, I think it was a big loss for them.
He also started the 2011 final as well, a cornerback. How on earth is he not in your team?
He's been there a long time now.
I wasn't gonna have him in the full back line. Simple as that. Like, I think that if you have, the reason why it kind of grinds my gears a little bit is because James McCarthy is fullback, and I think if the lesser of two evils is having James McCarthy at six and Keane O'Sullivan at fullback, but if you're picking a fullback, is Keane O'Sullivan one of the best fullbacks of the decade?
Keane O'Sullivan?
Yeah.
No.
No, exactly. So that's why I didn't pick him at fullback. It's as simple as that.
I didn't ask you about fullback. I asked you about the defence as a whole.
Okay, so then you get
into... You could have put James McCarthy in the midfield.
So then you get into... Sorry, I forgot that you picked him in the halfbacks. So then you get into my halfbacks, which are Jack McCaffrey, James McCarthy or Lee Keegan. I just think it's... And then you were trying to say, how do I get James McCarthy into the team? Do I put him into midfield? And then you look at that forward line, and there's no way I'm getting Michael Murphy into that forward line. So it comes back to the fact that Keane O'Sullivan is the one who drops out of that, say, that 11, that kind of frontmost 11. I just couldn't find any room for Keane O'Sullivan there. Is he next man in, potentially? Or is Carl Lacey next man in that halfback line, potentially? That's the question that I had. But I just had James McCarthy, for me, as a better complete footballer at number six. If James McCarthy was asked to do a sweeping role, he wouldn't have been as good as Keane O'Sullivan, but he wasn't. Instead, he proved himself to be one of the best halfbacks come midfielders that we've seen in the last couple of decades.
Again, I kind of went on, I was saying earlier on, the iconic type thing. So a guy who's kind of changed the position. and who has always been either a threat at the position or a real mainstay. And I think O'Sullivan fits that role, okay? Like Colm Boyle is
very close.
He's very, very close. Himself and Lacey were so close. Like, and Boyle is very, very hard done by. And it's literally a situation of, if you were, would you put him in corner back?
Colm Boyle was in your team at 7:29 a.m. this morning.
Was he? Yeah,
he was, yeah. But then he was, because, you know, and that's the thing. Certain teams had much stronger defenders, and then certain teams obviously had much more prowess in the forward line. And Mayo, of even though they had Killian O'Connor and these guys, you would probably say that their three stalwarts over the last 10 years was Higgins, Boyle and Keegan. You know, from what they did as well. Yeah. Like, you talk about attacking half backs, and Durkin is kind of getting there, you know, and guys who would always put you on the back foot.
Man markers too, on the other end as well.
Exactly, absolutely. And Higgins could go anywhere. You know, and I think the modern game with the defenders, I think it is a bit of fluidity in there, you know. Like Mark O'Shea is probably, but you know, you tip that, like Mark
in
O'Shea
terms of what he's done this decade. Like I was very heavily considering Mark O'Shea as well. Like if I was picking up my heart, of course he'd be in there. But yeah, like in terms of what he's done this decade, in terms of the peaks he's reached this decade, has he had as many good moments as Philly McMahon and Johnny Cooper?
Well, I think again, if we were picking it in 15, you'd say absolutely he's in. You know, he had an All-Star. I think he had five All-Irelands, three All-Stars. 2016 he retired. 2014 he got his All-Ireland.
Footballer of the Year in 07?
Yeah,
the peak is in a different decade.
But I still think that he was a go-to guy for Kerry in those 5 or 6 years from 2000 to 2015.
Yeah,
he was. And he was a guy who was man-marked on the best forward of the opposition team.
Always, yeah.
Always. You know, he marked Bernard Brogan at his pump, you know, and did well against those kind of fellas. He would have marked McManus. He would have been put on all of the opposition danger men. Now that's not to say that Higgins was either, and Cooper, I think it was very, very close. Like I've 7 Dublin players in my team, so I was kind of saying if you put Cooper in, that's 8, and you probably could have had another forward.
Well, Owen has 11.
Do I have 11?
Owen has 11 dubs.
Yes,
but lads, we're talking 7 All Ireland.
You are.
You've only given them a player for each All Ireland.
Well, what I'm trying to do is so.
Too many.
But I am trying to say though, like so if you went into the transfer market, right? You know, so
yeah, sure. You pick Mark O'Shea over the two boys. If you're sitting in the year 2015 and you've got a transfer, okay, maybe not 2013-14, and you've got a transfer market between O'Shea, Cooper, and Philly McMahon, you're picking Mark O'Shea. Maybe that's where I did go wrong a little bit. I got kind of carried away by the blue wave here a little bit. The success of Philly and Johnny Cooper actually blinded me more than their qualities over Mark O'Shea.
I think Cooper's very, very. Yeah, like I mean, Cooper is but so close.
I will say just for clarity, I'm not here for 1 second saying that Johnny Cooper and Philly McMahon are at their peak better footballers than Mark O'Shea was at his peak. I'm just saying that Mark O'Shea's peak came in a different decade.
O'Shea's peak crossed the decade. It was 05 to 15.
Exactly. And it was probably even later. It was probably like 07, 08 into its kind of 11, 12. Lacey is very unfortunate. Like Lacey was, he was another one of these guys.
He was essential to McGuinness.
Absolutely. Because he was one of the, I think even prior to Keegan, to a certain degree, and Boyle, he was one of these halfbacks that just went. You know, like, I mean, you look back, you think of those, you just see him raiding up and down the pitch, you know, with abandon just gone, you know, setting up things, getting involved, and really breaking that mold of that, you know, counter-attack kind of style that McGuinness had. He was phenomenal.
What's your take on Michael Murphy in midfield, Tommy? We've both gone from.
I'm splitting it, to be honest with you. And for me, I nearly would have put James McCarthy into your midfield and put Keane O'Sullivan in there. It was close. And Murphy is a full forward. I've always lamented the fact that Murphy didn't get enough game time at full forward. And I really do think that he could be put into either of your full forward lines.
I agree.
I really do think he could.
And
I think
he's
the perfect 14.
In your view?
Khan has loads of time left in his career, in my opinion.
But the heights he's already reached have been.
And when we're talking teams of the decade, like Conor McManus is one of the most skillful footballers that we've come across in the last decade.
Yeah.
But he hasn't won the All-Ireland that Michael Murphy has. So, like, for me, if I was to make that argument, I would potentially, if I had another midfielder, potentially slip Murphy into 14. But then again, who are you putting in there? Is it David Morin? Is it Colm Kavanagh? Is it Aidan O'Shea, the 2013 Footballer of the Year, Michael Darren McCauley? Did he do enough across a decade?
For me, there's a big drop off after a couple of those. Maybe it's just by dint of the fact that it's midfield. There's actually people who played midfield in other positions. But it seemed to me that if you lose Michael Murphy from your team, in terms of
he has to be in the team. Murphy's in the team.
I think. I was going to put McCarthy in midfield, and the thing about Murphy is I think he has to go in. And I was between O'Shea, but O'Shea had three All-Stars between 2000 and 2019. You know, and again, O'Shea gets an awful lot of flack because of Mayo's failings. And yes, he didn't have his best days, but he was a serious player for them. You know, and he dragged them through a lot of games, and he was the heartbeat for them, and he was a bit of a lightning rod for them, really, and he was a lightning rod for criticism that came his way. But I don't think I don't think he shirked his responsibility. I think of some other guys who maybe aren't in our lineups here, let them down at certain times. But I think he has to go in. Murphy has to go in, I agree, somewhere. Whether it's McCarthy, because I just think even this year, he's an absolute colossus.
Quick word in the forwards. If I had to pick, so say Michael Murphy gets drawn into my full forward line, if I had to pick Bernard Brogan, Conor Callaghan or Colin Cooper, I'd go for Conan Gooch.
Would you?
Cut Gooch.
No, I would cut Brogan. If I had to be limited to that for forward line. But what I would have done probably is move Con out to the half forward line and then drop Paul Flynn or something like that.
Let's talk Conor Callaghan here. We're talking a decade.
Yes.
Conor Callaghan has played 3 years in this decade.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think that is
how good he has been. Like one of the most dangerous inside forwards.
I kind of had a rule, you had to have a lot of hair in your face. And he's just too young for me, you know. So like
for me as well. I think
he's a bit too young.
Listen, if you can include Gooch in your decade, you can include Conan in your decade.
Ah, but Gooch,
like Gooch is 10, 11, 12, 13,
13 14,
14, 14. He's injured when they win the All Ireland. Remember, he's gone for the whole year.
So
Conan, you're talking 17, 18, 19. Granted, it's only 3 years, but it's still it's a stunning 3 years.
First year wasn't that
17 and 19.
Is it a stunning 3 years?
The middle year wasn't great. 18 wasn't fantastic.
It wasn't fantastic.
The goal against Tyrone, that's when everyone was like, "All right, this guy can do this."
Yeah, I know.
The Leinster Championship, he wins Man of the Match in the Leinster final that year. You know, the Leinster Championship is the biggest.
Jesus Christ, you know. You'd win the
We're talking
the
team in a decade here. Like, provincials don't come
No, you have to be. Like, McManus for me, again, you line up cornerback, you're saying to you, we're playing Monaghan, we're playing McManus. Like, I mean, even see what he did at the weekend.
Yeah.
Like, the guy is an absolute... He literally has carried that team and gone, listen, give me the ball. Give me the ball. I will do this. Like, and I know O'Callaghan, absolutely. Kilkenny was a strange one for me because some people either love him or you kind of go, ooh, is he really that? But again, he's a guy that has defined that forward line for Dublin.
That's it, yeah.
I'll be honest. There's no argument about Kieran Kilkenny in a team in the decade. No, but there's a serious question to be asked about Anthony Moyles, about not having Paul Flynn and his team.
And Dermot Connolly.
We don't even have to get into Dermot Deck. That's an obvious one. But like, Paul Flynn and Dermot Connolly.
Okay, I'd say...
That is the quintessential half-forward line.
Okay, I'll say about Connolly, right, that we just haven't seen him enough.
Oh, what are you talking about?
No, but
what
are you talking about? He's been off the board. He's been away. He's still, like, I mean, look, honourable mentions. I have in here honourable mentions. And he's in there.
That's all he wants, really.
Is Kieran McDonald of the last decade? He has to be in your team in a decade.
He's delivered as well.
More than McDonald.
Yeah, he has delivered. Like, I mean, he's up there. I still don't think as players go, right. So I have Ryan McHugh in there, right. So people say, oh, Jesus, why Ryan?
There's no hair in Ryan McHugh's face.
There's a bit. There's a bit more than Conn. I think McHugh is as important to Donegal as Murphy is.
Sure, but what have Donegal done in the Ryan McHugh era?
But like, you're making that same point now, and you made a point about Conor McManus.
Yeah. See, he's flipping his arguments.
They're the only team to beat Dublin in the Ryan McHugh era. He won that game for Donegal.
Okay, I suppose as you said back in the day, he's the Seamus Darby of this decade of the five in a row.
He won.
Seamus Darby wouldn't have been
the kick out.
McHugh's been a superstar.
Yeah.
But how is Jim Connolly not in there?
I just think that did Connolly do anything this year?
He played that unbelievable pass and
come on.
He meant that.
Did he do anything this year?
But the visa, the
no. Did he do anything last year?
No.
No.
But did Ryan McHugh do anything from 2010 to 2014?
Yeah, but okay, so 2010, did Dermot do anything in 2010?
Jim O'Connolly had a massive year 2011.
2010 to 2014 is unfair to judge against Ryan McGee.
I know.
You can only judge what players have been
there for. You know, he's absolutely right up there. I think, and Paul Flynn is another guy who was a backbone of the Dublin team. And I think between himself and Kilkenny, I think this is quite similar, right? I think O'Shea has to go in there because of what he does. Bernard Brogan is a guy who obviously carried that forward line for many a year, right? And the Gooch has to go in there for what he's done. And I'd probably, the Gooch, like O'Shea, kind of a little bit, he's kind of a little bit...
Well, Gooch would have been footballer of the year in 2011 had Kevin McManaman not scored that goal. I'm convinced of that. And then his evolution in 2013.
Correct.
And that's the reason why he's in there. He's been absolutely top class in two different positions after his peak. Or, well, I would say 11 is still very, very close to his peak, and I think that just is true greatness.
What about Mick Fitzsimons for Dublin defender?
Huge.
Like a
huge
guy
house.
Who's been there from
huge
10.
House.
He's what been all the way through the decade.
Killian O'Connor
I had in there
as
an honourable.
He's the most competitive. He's up against all-time greats in that position, and granted, he's the top scorer of all time.
Of all time,
in the Gaelic Football Championship.
But I still think when it came to the real, real, real crunch.
Like, you, like I still, when it comes to the crunch, who is the, right now, if you could pick any forwards in the country, it's Conor Callaghan. And that is why I picked him. If you go back 2 years ago, who was the forward that you would pick, an inside forward that would get you a goal, that would be the number one pick in a draft, or there was a GA draft, Conor Callaghan. That's unbelievable
success. 2 years ago.
I'm saying that. At the end of 2017, you would pick him, and that is why he's in there. Sorry to bring it back to Conor Callaghan. We are out of time. Who's got, like, what is the team of the decade?
I had the easy, I just had to sit in the fence here and kind of...
This is not an easy process.
You only have five footballers. You've only got five footballers of the year over those 10 years. There's no footballers of the year from 2011 to 2014 that's been chosen in either of your teams.
That time you're getting very technical now.
Like, I think essentially we can settle on the goalkeeper.
Yeah.
We can agree on the half back line to an extent.
Which of the 15s is better? That's what we want to know. We just want to pick a winner here.
Which of the 15s is better? Like, Moyes did a great shot with Conor McManus and Keane O'Sullivan. Owen. You're right with...
Owen's just gone for the Dublin team.
With Jim O'Connolly and Paul Flynn.
How many medals do they have?
It's not all about the medals, Owen.
You can decide you're the best team before half nine.
We can indeed. Yeah, it is 4 minutes past nine on this Tuesday morning, and I'm delighted to say that Hector O'Hyokagon is joining us in studio next to chat about his brilliant new series, Hector in the USA.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
They spoke about your arm not being down beside your side. I mean, this is not Irish dancing.
OTB Sports Radio.
Basketball would have been my main game.
The brand new sports radio station from Off the Ball.
That's my point. Don't play for us if you're a proud Englishman.
Now broadcasting 24 hours a day, live on the Go Loud app. Alexa.
You have a whole new world of possibilities.
Google Home, tune in, and offtheball.com/radio.
This is OTB Sports Radio. OTB AM.
Come with Jeremora Reach, lads. Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo! Oh, Costa go Costa. Southern style. Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. Shit. Roscoe. Kirte Shinte Veer. Lads, no big play kit, no big mess up. Christ, he's coming straight up to the car, Ross. Ross. Sorry, officer.
Good afternoon, sir.
Afternoon, officer.
I'm Corporal Rowland with Lawrence County Sheriff's Office. How are you?
I'm not too bad.
You got your driver's license on you, sir?
Yeah, 1 second. Sorry, sir.
Okay, Mr. Hector, that is?
Yeah, Hector O'Hyokagon. Thanks, officer.
Repeat your last name one more time.
It's O'Hyokagon. Okay. I'm from Navan.
Where's that at?
Navan's in Meath, County Meath's in Ireland. But I'm living in Galway, but I'm from Ireland.
Okay. What brings you here?
We're travelling around, me and my friends here. We're working for TG4, big channel in Ireland, and we're travelling through Georgia, all the southern states. Louisiana, Alabama, Texas, the whole lot.
Okay. Well, welcome to Georgia.
Thank you very much, officer.
Listen. I want you to drive safe, but you got to slow down. You were driving 97 miles an hour in a 45.
Sorry, officer. Won't happen again.
Slow down for me. I want you safe.
Thank you, officer.
Hector USA, as you can see on screen, it's happening at the moment on TG Car, and Hector O'Hookagon is with us in studio. You're very welcome, Hector.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks a
million. That is Southern hospitality right there.
Yeah, as you can see, there was a lot of pickup trucks going by, a lot of F-150s, a lot of GMCs. Welcome to Georgia, Mr. Hector. Southern hospitality, different world. And I suppose that's what we wanted to do, was give people a different slice of America. Mm. I mean, that clip there could have been a million miles from Central Park and a million miles from Faneuil Hall in Boston. And that's what you encounter the whole way as we meander through Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, the whole way across.
This is the map, actually, that you covered. 37 hours if you were to do it all in one go. Yeah. So, like, I guess Georgia is obviously where you start. That was a bit of episode one that we just saw. Like, there's a great sporting context to all of this because it is a religion to them. Football is a religion to people in the South, and it's college ball in particular that matters to them the most, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know what it is in the DNA of the Southern states, but that little enclave, that little corner of Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi especially, are producing pound for pound some of the best new sporting talent in America, year on year, in basketball, in football, and especially in football. So I don't know why it's coming from down there. I don't know why it's so popular. I mean, on the other night's show, we were in Georgia, went to a high school where these kids have been handpicked in Wheeler High School just outside Atlanta. It's one of the top high schools for basketball in Georgia. Everyone's watching them. One child had already changed school five times at 16 years of age with his family. Jobs, profession, accommodation, all because of the guy, how good he was at basketball. He was 16. His dream was to go to the NBA, and that's the level you're looking at. And now as we move into Alabama, it gets all about football, football, football. College sport, pound for pound, gets some of the biggest ratings, pay-per-view, TV ratings for anything. I mean, the March Madness, the basketball that happens in March, tens of millions of people watching it. And the amount of support for the local National Football League team in Atlanta or in Alabama is incredible. It's just hard to explain. I mean, when you get to Alabama, you realise there's only two sporting teams. There's Alabama State and there's Auburn University down south. It's incredible.
Yeah, let's have a look at Auburn University. This is another clip. This is the next episode of Hector USA.
Football is the economic engine for our athletics department. We have about a $150 million budget. And so with that, we pay our coaches, we pay our dietitians, our strength and conditioning people, we buy this equipment, we pay for their academic advisors, we pay for their travel, their uniforms, right? We pay for psychologists and psychiatrists. We pay for all those things for our young people. We have about 550 student athletes here in this athletics department and about 300 staff members. So from a business side, it's a minor company.
How do you fund all this?
We fund it by lots of different things, right? First and foremost are our fans. When they buy tickets to our football games, they also make donations. We also get revenue from multimedia rights, the TV revenue, the ESPN, and that helps us provide an experience that's like no other.
This is big business.
It's big business, but the reason why we do what we do is because we want to help young people be better in life. We want to help young people be better citizens.
How successful have Auburn been over the years?
Yeah.
With sending these guys into the next level?
It's kind of a calling card for us. We produce, you know, with weight rooms and facilities like this, and with people who care about your overall and holistic development and growth, we help prepare people physically, mentally, and emotionally to put them on the platform to have an opportunity to play at the professional level. A lot of these athletes are incredibly elite. Right, they've got muscles that we didn't know existed. They're faster than the average person. They can jump higher. They're mentally stronger. They're physically stronger, and that helps them make it to the next level. I got the eye
of the tiger. Yeah, so that's this week's episode of Hector USA. I was in Auburn at the start of this year, April, so the season's completely done. There's nothing happening in April football-wise, but yet everywhere you look is orange.
What brought you to Auburn?
A wedding. A mate of mine got married to a woman from Auburn, which is a great opportunity, actually, to go see a bit of the South, because like this is the sort of thing that you realise, that if you're going on a traditional holiday to the United States of America, what you'll get is you'll get your NBA game, you'll get your NFL game or whatever. But actually, if you want to actually see the real, I guess, mega side of US sports and what it does to kids and what they want kids to be,
yeah,
it's the college side of things. It is what they're doing in the Deep South, and what they're producing with these kids is absolutely out of this world. But I just couldn't get over just orange everywhere, and the season was over. Like the Airbnb we had, it was like you slept under an Auburn duvet, you know? It was like Auburn University duvet.
And the town is really small. It's a beautiful, picturesque town in southern Alabama, but it's almost like a college that's The red brick buildings are built onto the town, and this whole town has grown up with the college, and the college has just expanded. The only way I can describe it on to people as well is, and what I felt is coming home, is that if everybody in Connacht followed NUIG when they played a hurling match, if every man, woman and child in Connacht followed NUIG when they were playing a GA match, so that they wore their colours, that there was an 80,000-seater stadium beside NUIG and that everybody fed into that every time they played. That's the only way, or UCC or UCD, that's the only way I can describe it.
Yeah.
It's the love and the passion they have for their local university team and the rivalry, it's second to none. That's like $150 million per year for sport.
And do you subscribe to that theory that we're just doing it for the kids. We just want them to have a better future. Like, I mean, it's a hugely capitalist world.
Absolutely. I said, how is the whole thing funded? He said, well, first and foremost, our fans. Now, they do get 85,000 people in the stadium next door in the university. But I can tell you, that dressing room and the facilities I saw in the football department, there's some wealthy donations going in from some big hitters. I mean, there's a 50-foot statue of Cam Newton as you walk in. It's like
he's got a statue already, does he?
Yeah, it's a business.
Yeah,
it's a business, but isn't sport a business?
It's true.
And America has been the epicenter of sport business from a long time ago. But it's just amazing to see that the South is producing not only these college elite athletes in all sports, but that they produce the future stars of the NFL. And it's just incredible to see that, like the gymnasium, second to none.
Yeah, it looks incredible. Yeah. You're meeting Carl Lewis in a couple of weeks?
Couple of weeks' time. Our journey takes us through Louisiana. We're down into Texas. And in Texas, we decided to go to Houston. And then we got the phone call. It's hard when you're 6 months in preparation for this going, I wonder now who should we talk to in the Department of Athletics in Houston. Would there be any chance, we're an Irish television film crew, we're coming to Houston, would there be any chance to talk to Leroy Burrell and Carl Lewis? And then about 6 months of emails, and finally then you're staying in a motel near the University of Houston. I got up like a pig in shite that morning going, I'm about to meet one of the greatest sports people, one of the greatest athletes the world, America, probably the greatest athlete America has ever produced. Carl Lewis, and I couldn't believe it walking in. It was really warm. They were down at the track. I could see him in the distance, and I spent the day watching the future stars. I mean, it was just...
So what's he doing?
He is he's the head coach at the athletics department in the University of Houston, in tandem with Leroy Burrell, who was in the 4x100 American relay Olympic gold as well. So that's where Carl is. Carl started off in California and then moved down to University of Houston. He was an alumni there. So he has a lot of an affinity with Houston. He's been based there for a long time. He hasn't changed a bit. He looks like he's just won 4 goals in 1984. He's just like he's after knocking it out of the park at the long jump. I couldn't believe it was him, because to think of what he did,
yeah.
This is way back in the day when athletics was, it was there, but there was no Usain Bolt. To win 4 goals at 1 Olympics, and to have the long jump wrapped up after one jump because he wanted to rest his legs. So he said, what I'll do here is I'll win the gold in the first jump. And he clattered at 18:22, a world record. First jump, gold medal, move on to my next one. It's incredible.
And is he producing the next athletes, like as in track and field athletes for the United States, or is he working with footballers as well?
No, it's only athletics. And again, that's a huge market. So you've your basketball, you've your football down there, but the rivalry and the competition to produce the next All-American superstars. Their 4x100 team at the moment, he said, would make the Olympic final. Like, and these are 17, 18-year-olds.
Well, let's actually have a look at the episode. Here is Carl Lewis at the University of Houston.
Morning, Carl.
Oh.
Hector.
Hey, good seeing you.
Carl, I'm going to have to be honest. I can't believe I'm sitting here in Houston with you, and because you haven't changed a bit. You haven't changed a bit from that man who was blowing up my television. You were running out the side of my telly and into the kitchen. You were that fast.
Right.
Man, I cannot believe it.
Thank you.
I'm trying to hold it in here. Okay. Do you know? I'm trying to hold it
well,
in.
You're going to go halfway.
The first Olympic medal, was that the sweetest?
You don't know what it's like to win one until you do, and it was phenomenal. It was amazing in Los Angeles, and to do it in your home country, but it was also one of four, so I didn't have time to like, oh, this is great, and go out and because the next day I had to compete again. So when you go 7 out of 8 consecutive days, you don't really have time to celebrate each one. You do it in the moment, then your mind has to move on.
Leroy Burrell, it's an absolute pleasure to meet you.
Very nice to meet you as well.
I used to see you on television.
Mm-hmm.
Competing.
That was a long time ago.
At the highest, highest level.
Mm-hmm. And this is what happens at about 30 years later. So, you know, I had a really wonderful career. After I retired, I moved on and started coaching here at the University of Houston, my alma mater, and been here ever since. And I bought Carl back 3 or 4 years ago, and now so he's an assistant coach here, Carl Lewis,
Carl Lewis.
Wow.
The rivalry, and I've seen it on my journey, you know, I'm a sports fan across the board, I'm a massive athletics fan. The rivalry or the money and the infrastructure in college sports down the south, I knew it was big, but I didn't know it was this big. It's quite incredible through the southern states, isn't
it? Yeah, it's interesting because if you go to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, or Athens, Georgia, these places, the colleges have become so big because they're the industry in that community. Everyone gets into it. I think it's good for the college towns that they have them.
Well, we got a really good group of guys. Our 4x1 relay would make the Olympic final.
This Houston team,
yes,
would make the Olympic final.
Actually, our 4x1 and our 4x4 would make the Olympic final.
Like, when you see that, Hector, like, is it possible that, like, to even kind of argue against the notion that these absolutely world-class athletes aren't made? Like, I mean, they're obviously taking world-class talents, but they're turning them into world-class achievers because of the facilities that they have. That if somebody is in Ireland and growing up with the same talents as, say, those 4x1 runners in University of Houston, like, they've got about a fraction of a chance they've got with this insane project that they've got going on in the south of America.
Yes. I think it all goes down to finance again. I mean, they have the finances in place. They have the structure and infrastructure in place. Some of the athletes there were from the Caribbean, Trinidad and Tobago. I mean, they're scouting. They're scouting the whole area. They're scouting all Central America. And they're looking for it. But it's the same in baseball with the top Major League Baseball teams based in the Caribbean and then having all their scouts in Central America. It's just the conveyor belt. But just to be with Carl Lewis, man.
Yeah.
Carl Lewis, he looks incredible.
Did you partake in any athletic endeavours while you were over there?
Yeah, no, but I told him about the community games, where I was third in the community games under 12. I was pipped 100 metre sprint. I was just one of those things, Owen. It just didn't work out for me. But I took it on the chin. It was the 100 metres. It was the pinnacle of my sprinting career, community games. But, you know, as he said, some of our kids make the Olympic final. That's a serious achievement at 17, 18. It just shows you where sport is in that incredible place. So, good story.
What about the arm wrestling, though? This is what I'm trying to get at here. Like, I mean, there is a future of sport for everybody. Like, when you don't win that community games gold medal, somebody should have been coming over to you at that point saying, "Listen, Hector, there's an arm wrestling future for you."
Here we go. Did you ever arm wrestle at the back of class?
No, I've never actually. Yeah, I have, but I always lost.
Seemingly, it's all about in the wrist and the twist, and you're allowed to lift this a little bit. So we walked into a pub in San Antonio, where the world champion was pulling. They call it pulling.
Okay, pulling, that's illegal.
Yeah, they call it pulling. There are pulling clubs all over Texas, and especially in San Antonio, and it's pulling. $10,000 if I could beat this guy who's the world champion. You want to see the size of the biceps. He was a very cocky guy, and they were pulling clubs from all over San Antonio, full of testosterone, in a beer garden, in a pub in San Antonio. It was incredible.
So a pulling club would mean something very different in Ireland. That's in episode 5 of Hector USA.
Arm wrestling. So look, we wanted to touch on sport the whole way through, and it was just brilliant, brilliant.
Last one, Buddy Stevens. Last chance, you had the opportunity to meet him as well.
Yeah, my eldest boy Rian, who's 15, big sports fan, big Atlanta Falcons fan. When he knew his dad was going to Georgia, first thing I had to do was get him the Falcons jersey. Then he got me in about 3 years ago. He at 13 or 14 got me into Last Chance U. He's like his daddy, like sport. So we started sitting down watching this team in East Mississippi in the middle of scuba in rural Mississippi, and coach Buddy Stevens. And it was one of the greatest reality sporting shows I've seen on Netflix. An incredible story of some, you've seen it, have you seen it?
I've dipped in and out of it.
A college that rehabilitates some really, really fantastic players who have gone to big franchise clubs, have been the wrong side of the tracks, have got in trouble, the club can't manage them, the franchise can't manage them, they're in the NFL, they're about to break in, and they're sent to be rehabilitated in scuba in rural Mississippi. How could I describe scuba in Mississippi? It's like going to a village like Termefecken in Loud.
It would be like going to Crusheen in County Clare.
It's not that bad, surely.
It's like going to the middle of nowhere. A 7-Eleven, a petrol station, and then the college. It's like going to Agricultural College in Mount Bellew, County Galway. You know the way they strategically put agricultural colleges in the middle of nowhere? Well, that's where Scuba is. And Buddy Stevens molds them back into some of the best young footballers in the country. It was incredible to spend the day with this guy, the star of Last Chance U.
Class. So if you had to pick one highlight from the season or something that's still to come, what should we be looking out for? It doesn't have to be sports related.
Wait till I see. Listen. I was sitting on the Mississippi. The Mississippi River was beside me. We like the Shannon. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Kerry.
Right. What's the biggest river in Kerry?
That's a very good question, actually. The River Lown or the River Flesk or something?
Yeah. We know the Shannon. We might know the Nile. The Mississippi drains a third of America. It is a super highway of business and commerce the whole way down to New Orleans. When you're sitting on the banks of the Mississippi, in the middle of the state of Mississippi, with the Delta blues music in the background, with the cotton fields in front of you, all I could think of was Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. Two blackguards who built a little boat who said, I'm fed up with school, I'm going to mitch for the next couple of weeks, and I'm out in the Mississippi. It's an incredible rich part of the world, and I hope to bring an audience on a unique journey through 8 states on Hector.
They say Mississippi is the worst state. Statistically, in pretty much all the statistics, Mississippi kind of falls below every other state. So it is like the worst state that's out there, but there's an attraction to that.
But you
disagree with that even?
I don't buy into any of that. The richness comes from the people. Yeah. I love being with local people in the middle of nowhere, whether it was Siberia or Mongolia last year or rural Mississippi this year. It's only by going to meet the local people that you get a real feel for where you are.
Hector USA, Thursday, 9:30.
9:30. Massimo Gulamokkadi and Off the Ball Posse. Welcome back from Japan. Good to see you in one piece.
Thanks a million, Hector Gormagos.
Falter up.
I think, you know, the World Cup was no pressure, no expectation. It was our chance to kind of show people what we kind of knew ourselves we were capable of. And then it obviously gave us a huge boost in our Olympic qualification journey. So our ranking went up to 8th in the world, and that meant that we got that home draw. And it just made a world of difference for who we would end up playing in the qualifier. And we said straight after the World Cup that we set out with the goal of achieving Olympics, and that was very much still the goal, and that's what encouraged us to get straight back out onto the pitch after we won that silver medal. And no one kind of went wayward or went to the wayside, because that was what we'd set out to do. And so, yeah, it was massive for us from a confidence booster point of view, and also to get people, you know, if we didn't do what we did last summer, we wouldn't have had 6,000 plus people in the stands yesterday and on Saturday. So,
yeah, that's Katie Mullen chatting to Richie McCormack on last night's Off the Ball. And Buddy Stevens is the episode that Hector is doing this week on Hector USA Thursday at 9:30 on TG Cahir. And if you missed any of our chat with Hector of Yurkagon, you can catch it back on youtube.com/offtheball a little bit later on. Right, the jury is still out, to be quite honest with you. Myself and Anthony tried to come up with the ultimate team of the decade, combining my team with his team. And here's what we've got. This is a working kind of team. That is not the team. There has been a change to that that's just come up. Stephen Cluxton, Mark O'Shea, Keane O'Sullivan, Keith Higgins, Jack McCaffrey, James McCarthy, Lee Keegan, Brian Fenton, Michael Murphy. And the forwards, Dermot Connolly, which is the last minute change, as you can see from that graphic, Kieran Kilkenny, Paul Flynn, Cullen Cooper, Bernard Brogan, and Conor McManus. So I've made a lot of, you know, I've allowed you to have a few things here. I've allowed you to have Mark O'Shea. I've allowed you to have Keane O'Sullivan.
Allowed me to have Mark O'Shea. All the people you went, I'll give you Mark O'Shea.
And
I wonder why.
Conor McManus. That's I've given up.
If
Conor
I said
Callaghan.
Paul Gainey, you would have allowed me to have him too, probably.
For sure.
And David Moore.
You know, if you picked me to be in the team, any Kerry man, just put them in there.
I think there's been a bit of wiggle room, and there's been more wiggle room. My whole, you know, Keane O'Sullivan, the number six pivotal role, he's now shooting at fullback. So, I don't know. I give you Cooper. That means O'Shea has to come out. But that means I have to put someone in the forward line. Aidan O'Shea is probably unlucky.
So who are you putting into the forward line then? Or like into the forward line?
I think
like
your half forward line.
So you would be picking Aidan O'Shea over Dermot Connolly.
Yes.
As a half forward.
Centre half forward.
The decade of 2000 to 2019.
He's three All-Stars. Connolly is two.
Who's the better player? Who has been the better player? Aidan O'Shea, phenomenal player. I think he was excellent at midfield this year.
Who's been the most important? Who has been the more important player to his team?
But you see, then Conor McManus would be a shoe-in and I wouldn't have even considered not putting him into my team.
Well, if I was picking a 15 tomorrow, I'd kind of go, okay, so Connolly, yes, he has a lot of attributes, but I'm saying, is he a starting man on my starting 15 tomorrow with everything, all the different stuff brought in, or do I want to go with, say, a Flynn or a Kilkenny or a Conor Callaghan? I think there's just guys ahead of him.
Well, if you're bringing in all the different...
Or Ryan McHugh.
If you're bringing in all the different stuff that comes in, Anthony, then you're saying, Cooper, get out of the team, you're almost 40. Like, you can't be judging things on where things are. Like that's not how it works. You're picking things based on the greatness of the player and the brilliance that they've shown throughout the decade.
I think O'Shea has been an ever-presence in the Mayo and has been a guy who's been at the forefront of Gaelic football for the last 10 years. So you know, we are trying to do a decade here.
Have him. So who are you getting rid of, Connolly or Flynn?
I'll give you Cooper.
Okay, Johnny Cooper in, Mark O'Shea, oh, you're out.
O'Shea, you're getting rid of Mark O'Shea.
You know what?
For all the things he's done for Kerry.
I'm an unbiased journalist.
Oh my God, that's shocking.
And then, are you getting rid of Connolly or Flynn?
The O'Shea, the dynasty, they'll be after you. You didn't know that.
They will. They certainly will. But at least he's in there. He was in there.
I'd like to keep Mark.
So you want to keep... Okay, Grant, I'll give you Mark O'Shea.
I like that. Okay, we'll go with that.
We'll go with that. So Aidan O'Shea doesn't make it. Very close on the bench. Player of the decade.
A lot of honourable mentions. Tyrone haven't been mentioned.
No Tyrone.
Like,
no,
I mean, Petey Hart.
It's tough to make any case for Peter Hart over that halfback.
I'd give Colin Kavanagh an honourable mention. I think Kavanagh, again, for the style of play, what he did, and when he is missing from that kind of sweeper role in behind the six, they're exposed. Like, I mean, even more so than Sean.
Right.
I think Sean gave him something specific.
Yeah.
But I think Colin Kavanagh was pivotal. Like, I mean, if you're a manager, you're sitting there on whatever night it is with your selectors, who were one of the first guys you put down in the team sheet? Kavanagh was one.
Because of the role he fulfilled, and he was absolutely exceptional at it. And he still is exceptional at it, let's not forget.
Yeah.
I'll give you player of the decade. We are a team working on this, so I'll give you that.
Yeah. Again, I think player of the decade has to be someone who has pretty much nearly spanned the decade. So,
but that's very tough. Like, some players' career span from an 05 to a 17 or...
But I'm saying the majority. Okay, so you can't give it to O'Callaghan, for example.
But Brian Fenton only came midway through the decade and he will be my banker for...
Fenton was 15. I'd give it to either... I'd give it to Cluxton.
Stephen Cluxton, of course. I kind of... Stephen Cluxton.
Right at the mix. I was going to say McCarthy or McCaffrey. Right. But I think McCarthy's up there. Like, McCaffrey was...
Sorry, what am I talking about? Jack McCaffrey is player of the decade. I would give it to Jack McCaffrey.
I know, Cluxton.
Jack McCaffrey has been the best footballer we've seen this decade and one of the best of all time.
No, Cluxton. And you know the amazing thing is Cluxton only actually won. Like, I was going through, there's some really funky goalkeepers who have been in since 2010. Like, Cluxton actually didn't win a whole pile. He won very few All-Stars.
He had a long old gap before this year, winning Footballer of the Year.
Yeah, so I think, as again, a guy who changed the game, he's in there for me.
Our final team, the off-the-ball football team of the decade, is as follows. Stephen Cluxton, also footballer of the decade. Mark O'Shea, Keane O'Sullivan, Keith Higgins is your full back line. The halfbacks are Jack McCaffrey, James McCarthy and Lee Keegan. Brian Fenton and Michael Murphy make up your midfields. A half-forward line, an awesome half-forward line, if I say so myself. Dermot Connolly, Kieran Kilkenny and Paul Flynn. And then inside, three of the best sharpshooters perhaps you've ever seen. Cullen Cooper, Bernard Brogan and Conor McManus. That is a wrap, ladies and gentlemen. That is a fantastic team. And congratulations, Anthony, on taking part in all of that. Thanks for joining us this morning. We'll chat to you soon.
Cheers.
That is our lot on OTB AM this morning. You can stay tuned to the Off The Ball channels and OTB Sports Radio throughout the day. And if you have missed any of this morning's show, you can catch Joseph O'Brien, the sports pages, Football with John Bruin, the team of the decade, of course, and Hector in the USA. And you can catch the podcast back very soon on offtheball.com/podcast or on the Goal Out app as well. You can watch everything back as well on youtube.com/offtheball and make sure to click the subscribe button. Our final Rugby World Cup show is coming your way from midday today. Neil Tracy will be in the hot seat. Tonight and Off The Ball then, Champions League with Damien Delaney and much, much more besides. We'll see you here tomorrow morning, Wednesday morning from 7:30. Good luck.
That was an Off The Ball Podcast Network presentation.